Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. We have an album coming out on May 26th.
Yeah, Teddy Bear Fresh.
Teddy Bear Fresh. It's us and Currency and Smoke Dizza and Bun B and Sway and Angie and Just Blaze and Jazz Cartier and Michael Christmas and Tunji Ige and...
And we're on there.
Did I miss anybody?
I don't think so.
Pre-sale is up right now on iTunes. Guys, we made this album for you, for our listeners of the podcast. Everybody who tunes in every week, you're really going to be surprised. You're really going to be satisfied. It's a dope project, and we started doing our press run this past week.
We went to Hot 97 to see Nessa. And Nessa's a girl who we've met twice, always had like pleasant conversations, never like anything deep. You know, those type of conversations that you have with people at, like, clubs or whatever.
Yeah,
where it's
just
like,
saying hi and saying, like, how are you? And knowing that, like, I've seen you in a friend's Instagram and you've seen me in that same friend's Instagram, but never at the same time.
Right, like, she doesn't know our last names. We don't know her last name. Like, she probably can't tell us apart. You know, like, that sort of relationship. So we end up going to this interview, and it's a good conversation.
45-minute conversation, really good questions. I don't think the video's out yet, but it should be soon. On hot97.com.
So at the end of the interview, Nessa runs over to the other studio and her assistant says to us, "Have you met Colin?"
And we're like, "Who is Colin?"
And he's like, "Oh, that's Nessa's boyfriend."
So, you know,
we meet lots of people.
Yeah, maybe we met him. I said, yeah, we met him. And then I was like, "No, we haven't met. I don't know. I don't know who she's dating. No, maybe we have." And we walk into the studio.
And first of all, there's a white kid in the, like, green room or something.
Yeah, sitting with, like, a jacket, and he looks familiar. And I was like,
yeah, we met him,
sure.
There's Colin. Yeah. Colin is on the bench. There he is.
Yeah, hey, Colin.
And then the assistant keeps walking us into the studio, and we're like, oh, no, that's not Colin. In fact, this other guy in front of us now is Colin, and that is...
Colin Kaepernick, the football player... who is dating Nessa.
And we had no idea. Well, that makes...
No, we've never met him.
He's a very memorable Colin.
And truth be told, Nessa is there bragging on our new project, and she's like, I'm so excited about the guys, and they're doing this great press run, and they have an amazing project, and I'm so happy for them, and they're working so hard. You know how hard it is for them to do everything, the PR, the marketing, the A&R, the product managing.
So Nessa says all this, right? And Eric and I are standing there, like, sort of nodding our heads, but also thinking about the fact that Colin Kaepernick has also faced some difficulties in his career life. Namely, I don't know, facing racism from half of the country for taking a knee.
So where do we connect with this guy? And by the way, he couldn't have been any nicer.
He is so nice.
So nice. Smiling the whole time. He's so happy for our success, and we did not know.
How do we at all connect with him?
Because you have done, you know, amazing things in the face of true evil. We
threw an early retirement party for Lloyd Banks. I mean, like, what could we possibly talk to Colin Kaepernick about? It was just like, it was so crazy.
We walked out of there and Jeff was like, did you know they were dating? I said, I had no idea. He says, does anyone know they're dating? And then you pulled up her Instagram and it's like,
it's all pictures of Colin Kaepernick. It's very obvious.
Yep.
So, anyway, now we're following Nessa.
So there was that.
And shouts to Colin Kaepernick.
We had another weird run in this week. Do you remember what it was?
I do. You can't forget this.
We were walking over to go see DJ Green Lantern perform downtown on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, the Privilege opening. Shout out to Adriel Ortiz. Shout out to everybody who was in town.
A lot of people in the building that night. But before we even got there, shout out to Amir Abbasi, Blame the Label. But before we even got there, we're walking down the street. And we didn't say anything to each other, but we both saw this sedan...
It was like a silver four-door.
The doors open, and these three dudes get out of this car.
At the same time.
They all looked like... Do you remember when Earl, the rapper, dressed up like Joe Budden, and he had like the bald cap over his head?
Everybody was 5'1", maybe. 5'1" tops.
It looked like aliens.
They all looked like 14-year-olds who had seen like 1,000 years.
And they were wearing giant suits.
Yeah, all matching giant suits. All of them had matching mustaches. And all of them were bald.
And they all looked like they were on a million drugs because they were all leaning over like a V8 commercial.
Yeah, like slumped over. Like they had just like been in a car accident and they were just like walking out for the first time.
It was so crazy.
It was so, they did so
not,
crazy.
They did not go to the Green Lantern event, by the way, as far as I saw. But I don't know where they went. I don't know where they were coming from. It was bizarre.
It was like they had just beamed down from another planet. Like,
Shout out to those guys. The biggest problem with that is that no one else was there to see this. That was the biggest problem.
Right. It's almost like we were on drugs and then...
Maybe we were those guys. Maybe we were the ones in the suits with the bald caps looking like...
mini Steve Harveys, but also old Steve Harveys who are also young.
Don't know. Anyway, today on the podcast, we have our friend Dallas Martin, who is an A&R for MMG. And listen, if you're looking for stories about Rick Ross, about the making of every Meek Mill project, every Wale project, the Omarion song, like you want stories about 2 Chainz and Future and Jhené Aiko. I mean, you want a lot of recent history from somebody who was actually there.
That's what you're going to get.
This is a guy who, you know, made it from Flint, Michigan.
We didn't even talk about the water, by the way, did we?
No, we didn't. But shout out to everybody up there who's somehow making it through. And fuck you to all the people in government who can't get them clean water. I mean, that's just unbelievable. But this is a guy who made it out of Flint, Michigan, who dealt with a lot of loss, which we get into, a lot of non-believers. It's a great episode. Shout out to Dallas Martin, and shout out to everybody who was making sure that this would happen.
Yeah, that's what, like Ron Stew.
You're on Stew. A lot of people wanted to make sure this happened. We're glad it happened. Great interview. One more thing.
Yeah,
which is May 26th, our debut album Teddy Bear Fresh comes out on all the streaming services, but it's on iTunes as well. Let's put up some good numbers. Let's put up some great numbers. Let's surprise everyone. Go hit that pre-sale button. It's only $8.99 on iTunes right now. Teddy Bear Fresh. Spread the word. Guys, this is the album for you. Jeff, anything else?
Nope, that's it.
When do you want to get into this podcast?
Right now.
Yo, what up? Eric, a.k.a. Cat in the Hat, a.k.a. Poppin' Them Thang.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. All My Friends Are Dead, a.k.a. Last of the Mohicans.
And what's good? It's Dallas. Atlantic Records in the building representing.
Yeah, so this is a waste of time with this. Actually, literally, we're in the building.
We are in the building.
In Atlantic Records right now.
Yeah, we are avoiding construction on our Upper West Side apartment.
That's right.
So yeah, so shouts to the drills.
Dallas, we normally don't even leave our apartments. We came here for you because we really wanted to make this podcast happen. It's a long time in the making.
I'm excited, man. I feel honored, you know what I'm saying? And I've been waiting to talk to you guys, big fans.
Thank you very much. First of all, you know, we speak to a lot of people, obviously from New York. We speak to a lot of people from Atlanta. We don't usually speak to a lot of people from Flint, Michigan.
I know, right? So I guess that's definitely been like one of the things that I had to battle coming up in the music industry, because, you know, New Yorkers are super serious about New Yorkers and, you know, the fabric and the authenticity of the game and just people being from out here, you know, being part of it. So I'm glad they opened the doors and finally let me in, but it definitely took a lot of work.
What do you grow up listening to in Flint, Michigan? What is the music of choice up there?
See, that's what the dope shit was about Michigan, you know what I'm saying? We had people that loved the East Coast, so I grew up heavy on Biggie, you know what I'm saying? Then a lot of people love Pac, and a lot of people love the Midwest stuff, you know what I'm saying?
So from Bone Thugs,
Twista, Crucial Conflict, just like a taste of everything. So, and then I went to school in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Then I got a chance to really understand the culture and really fall in love with the music from the South.
Well, what did your folks do up there?
Really, like, my parents were together until, like, I was in junior high, so they split. So my dad was just doing, you know, jumping from job to job, and my mom worked retail.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was really definitely like a humble beginning, you know what I'm saying, to my life. And, you know, just hard work and parents, blue collar, just, you know, normal
this
shit.
This is... past that, like, Michael Moore time.
Yeah, it's definitely past that time, but it was, like, still, you know, they were, you know, the city was really known for a lot of the, you know, plants, the auto plants and stuff, and they were shipping them all down south or into, like, Mexico and stuff. So a lot of people were definitely losing their jobs. So it definitely was, like, a lot of crime that was starting in the city when I was coming up, you know. But, you know, a lot of people, the city had a lot of basketball. Basketball was really big. We had a lot of players coming out of the city that, you know, went went pro and stuff. So, you know, it was still a chance to see success, but only on a sports level.
What kind of cars did your parents drive?
Yo, so this, me and my dad just came to visit me in L.A. because I just got a new car, you know what I'm saying? We were talking about it. So my dad had a Caprice, right? The whole right side was dented, yo. Like, you couldn't even get in on the right side of the car. So.
Yo, but when you look at it from the other side, though. Yeah.
When you look at it from the other side, they like, oh, that, okay. And you see the other side. I, like, asked my dad. I was like, Dad, how much did you buy that car for? He said $350. Yeah. I was rolling. So, like, he would drop me off at school. I would make him drop me, like, a block down the street, you know what I'm saying? So everybody wouldn't see me, so I wouldn't get made fun of and stuff. So it definitely was like, you know, a funny beginning.
Do you
know
still
what I'm saying?
Buy American made cars? Like, are you strictly like a Chevrolet or Ford or
Dodge? I mean, I used to love Chevrolets, you know, when I was coming up, like Impalas were like the thing, yeah. You know what I'm saying? But now, you know,
now you're more like a Malibu guy?
More like, yeah, kind of like a Malibu Benz type thing.
So when you were getting ready to graduate high school, was there a thought that you were just going to stay in state?
No, so that's a great question. So I knew if I stayed in state to go to school, because basically when you're in state, you have the opportunity to go to Michigan State. They all basically just make everybody from Michigan go to Michigan State, you know what I'm saying? Because yeah. You could get in-state tuition,
yeah.
Which you only have to pay like $2,500 a year.
That's amazing.
To go to college for yeah. In-state residents. But I knew if I stayed in Michigan, there was no chance that I would be able to break into the music game, which I was really passionate about. I knew what I wanted to do in high school.
Well, how'd you know?
Because I was a big fan of music. I would listen to music. This like when Napster stopped popping.
Yeah.
So like, you know, in Michigan, you don't have money to go buy CDs every day.
Right.
So this is my first opportunity to get to listen to everything, even though it was, you know, downloading illegally now. You know what I'm saying? It was a chance for me to hear everything early and efficiently. So I would just be literally, when I get home from school, listening to music from like 3 p.m. to 3 a.m., my mom be like, go the fuck to sleep. You know what I'm saying? So I'm listening to everything. So right then and there, I was like, yo, I want to get into this, but I can't sing, rap, dance, nothing. So then this is like when the Rockefeller, Murder, Inc. and all this stuff was going on. So I'm like, well, who's this guy? Herb got like, or who's Pup? Like, what do they do? They don't do music. Or Dane, what does he do? So I started studying. And I was like, yo, I want to be like them. They're behind the scenes. And I started learning what A&R was before anybody could teach me.
Well, where did you learn that? Like, were you reading like XXL or like Scratch
watching
or
the movies? Mm-hmm. Buying books, you know what I'm saying?
So it just like backstage.
Backstage and, yeah. Was like a big pivotal part in my life, you know.
Did
backstage
you feel was huge for me. Did you feel really isolated up there?
Definitely.
It's not New York and it's not LA.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you're in high school, you're a senior, you're telling people I'm about to move to Atlanta and do music and I'm gonna be in the, and they're like, yo, shut up, boy. Go to Michigan State and you're gonna do whatever you do. But it definitely was like, I was definitely an outsider with my way of thinking.
Right.
So were your friends also like rap nerds?
No, all my friends were athletes. They all play basketball. All my friends play basketball.
Did you play basketball?
I did. Then I realized I wasn't going to be good enough to go to the NBA by the time I was a junior because they was way better than me. I said, you know what? If I ain't better than them now, it's not like I'm about to start being better than them. So I need to figure out a different life purpose.
Everybody gets better late in life. Yeah. It's the two chains effect.
Real shit.
So where'd you apply in Atlanta?
Clark Atlanta.
Strictly?
Well, that's the only one place that really accepted me because I got bad grades in high school. They accept anybody. They just want your check. So
right.
Great. I'm going down there.
We'll talk about some people who went to Clark Atlanta.
Don Cannon, yep. Shaka Zulu, mm-hmm. Who else? DJ Drama.
Yep.
Scotty Beam.
Scotty Beam.
Yep. Damian Lemon went there, right?
Damian Lemon. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people, man, that yeah. went to Clark. But and I knew if I got to Atlanta and just been able to set up, that I would make it. I just knew that in my heart.
Did you know anyone else who was making that trip?
So that's a funny story too. So my parents were against me going there because they didn't want to pay it.
Are you an only child? Do you have any
other
siblings?
I have one little brother.
Okay.
So they were like, yo, we're not supporting this, whatever, whatever. And I'm like, well, I'm going. They were like, well, we're not paying for it. We don't have the money. So I'm going to figure it out. You know, I was like, I'm going to go out there 2 weeks before registration starts to try to figure it out. So I had a friend that actually, she went to Clark Atlanta. She was from Flint, too. She went there before she connected me with a few friends out there. The friends were Don Cannon.
That's unreal.
And when he was working with the artist, they had an artist at the time. It was Lotta, Darkman's little brother. What was his name? Damn, I forgot his name. But anyways, they all stayed like in the same dorm.
Yeah.
So she introduced me to them. So basically, I went out there. She introduced me. I had a few connections. So I went out there 2 weeks early. And I went to the registration every day, and they were just helping me figure out how to get loans to get in school. But, like, to get out there, it was a girl that was going to Spelman. I asked her family. I'm like, yo, can I take my crate and just can y'all, like, let me ride down to Atlanta with y'all? And they were like, your parents cool with it? I was like, yeah, kind of. And they just let me ride down to Atlanta with them. And they just let me – I stayed with her for
– You made that drive.
I made the drive with them.
Yeah.
They let me stay with my friend that was from there for, like, she said, you got 2 weeks to figure it out or you got to go back.
Holy shit.
And
You have gotten back? Walking,
like, I would have been on Greyhound. I would have been on Greyhound, sad as shit. But I was determined not to fail, so I just went out there and I went to the registration and they helped me figure out to take out loans under, you know, my name. And I got the loans and I was short $2,500. That was the $25 you needed to stay on campus for, like, in room, like, boarding.
Mm-hmm.
And I called the only rich person in my family that I never talked to. And I said, listen, I know I don't talk to you that much. You know, I love you, but I'm calling. I need $25. I want to go to college. I'm trying to do something. And she said, let me think about it. She called me the next morning, like, I'm going to send you the money.
That's amazing.
And wow. That's how I got into Clark Atlanta.
Yo,
do you guys talk more?
Oh, we talk all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
She's my favorite auntie now, for sure. And I paid her back.
Yeah.
So it was definitely worth it.
So you get down there. Do you have an idea of what you want to major in? Is there something
yeah,
in music?
Yeah, yeah. I knew I wanted to be in music, but I knew everybody in music had a business spirit, so I wanted to be in marketing. Mm-hmm. So I studied business marketing at mm-hmm. Clark Atlanta.
Did you have a job down there too?
So the great thing about what I started doing at Flint, when I realized I couldn't play basketball no more, I started throwing, like, little high school parties. So I would do a party, like, once a month and charge everybody $10.
What was the name of it?
We had different names. Mm-hmm. Like, it would just be like
corporate hoes and CEOs.
Yeah, it'd be like some of the most rent, like, whatever was, like, the hot song or movie. It'd be the name of the party. And in Flint, you only way your party would pop, you had to get this DJ called DJ Scribble. He lived in Lansing for some reason. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved him, so he came to Flint. If you got him, paid him $250, your party's gonna be lit. So I made
a deal. Throwing parties, like, dude, where's my party?
Yo. So I basically threw the parties, and I got, like, really good at promoting. So when I got to college, I formed my crew. And we start throwing parties, and we did them at, like, little restaurant, you know, 18 and, you know, up parties and shit.
Mm-hmm. Denny's. Waffle House.
Yeah, just random places. And it just grew and grew, and that's how, like, I was determined to build my brand while I was trying to figure out how to break into music.
And did you stay in touch with Don Cannon and meet Drama?
Me, Drama, Cannon, we've been friends since then. Shaka Zulu's a mentor of mine, I feel like, at this point. And, you know, everybody from Clark that really does music, I feel like we stick together pretty
also
tough.
All those colleges are together. How do you find out, like, what Atlanta as a city is like?
Well, I mean, you know, this is, like, just a good time for music, and just, like, you know, the city is vibrant, you know, nightlife. And as you, like, become a promoter, you start throwing parties, you meet the real promoters. So you get access to the big clubs, and they'll let you in. They'll let you, like, not be in a section, but, like, yo, go play the bar or just stay out of people's way, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, I just won the affection of a lot of people out there that really just believed in me. And I just got a lot of social currency being broke out there.
Did you ever run into Scooter Braun down there?
Yes. Scooter, so I could talk about that later, but Shakir mm-hmm. Stewart is the person who brought me into the game. Yep. Rest in peace, Shakir Stewart. Shout out. And Scooter used to go visit him a lot and have meetings with him, and I would see Scooter all the time coming mm-hmm. to see Shakir.
Yeah. Yeah.
How different is Atlanta from Flint?
Man, Flint has nothing major going on. No major sports teams, no, like, major driver to make money. It's a very small, locked-in city. It was, like, probably, like, four major high schools. I want to say, I really don't know the population. The population might have been, like, 100,000 when I was there. But, you know, it was definitely a city when I was coming up. They had a lot of kids that had, like, a lot of style. So it was like, a lot of vibrant kids at the time that didn't know what they wanted to do.
And who was running the city in Atlanta? Was that, like, Lil Jon?
At the time?
Yeah.
Man, I got there 2002, Trap or Die drop.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Jeezy was...
Did you ever see him at, like, strip clubs?
I seen Jeezy everywhere. He used to be on... By the way, all the rappers played the campus. Mace was going to school at Clark at the time. Yeah. I think everything, like... It was rapper heaven at Clark. They was trying to get all the bad chicks. Like, it
Yo,
was
who
crazy.
Plays Homecoming during those years?
Man, shit. Pastor Troy.
Yeah.
Damn, that's crazy. We had a whole... It was just random people who was hot. Chingy.
Oh my God.
You know, Ludacris was on fire in 2002.
I-20.
I-20, all of them, man. It was crazy. It was just a great city. You had T.I., you had Luda, you had Jeezy. It was like the city was just crazy with the people.
Yeah, what artist did you really like attach to at that point? You're like, yo, this guy's going to be like
T.I. big. Was my favorite. I listened to T.I. in high school. I used to play his music in high school. I'm serious. And people was like, what the fuck are you listening to? Because his accent was so different from what we were used to. Because when you're from Flint, you don't meet people from different cities on a regular. So when you hear a different accent, you like, what is that? So it's like, people don't travel from Michigan.
Yeah.
The furthest they might go is Chicago. It's a 5-hour drive. That's like that's doing it big.
Yeah, right.
Major when you go to Chicago. But when you live in Flint, you don't travel. You don't take vacations. It's not like, yo, I just got back from the Bahamas with the fam. It's none of that.
Yo, so what's some real Flint like? Language, like what's a word or like phrase that's real Flint?
What up though? Yeah. Same Detroit, you know what I'm saying? What up though? That's our thing.
Well, how far were you from Detroit?
An hour.
Yeah.
So, you know, people definitely, I have family in Detroit, so I would be back and forth a lot. And Detroit was like, you know, the biggest thing. You go to Lions and Pistons game, and that was your touch of like seeing some real success. Yeah.
Coney Dogs.
Some nice cars or something, because you don't see no nice cars in Flint like that.
Did you care about Eminem?
My little brother did. So I remember my little brother bought his album. Eminem came out with another rapper that year. I forgot who it was. It was like the same week. It was like a good rapper. And my brother bought Eminem and stuff. I'm like, yo, what is this? Then my brother used to play it so much. I was like, this dude is really rapping. Like, what is going on? He like, I told you. And my brother's not a hip-hop head, but he is on the low, you know?
Right.
So my little brother put me on Eminem early, the first album, Slim Shady. And he used to play it so much, I wanted to strangle him.
Like, yo, whoa, that's very Eminem lyrics.
Yeah.
Were you like, yo, like, I think my brother has problems?
Yeah, I'm like, yo, you got something you want to talk to me about, bro?
So down at school, you're a marketing major. Who was your roommate?
I had a random roommate from L.A. He was like a ex-Crip something. Yeah. It was like some random stuff.
So did you?
I remember saying, because we say cuz in Flint.
Yeah.
Like, what up, cuz? He was like, yo, I'm saying that. I like what you talking about. He from a real banging culture. So I'm like,
all
right, bro.
He threw out all the red in your closet. That's right. Yeah. Wouldn't go to Braves games.
We went to L.A. one time, and we were going to do some work with Nipsey, and we got a rental car that they gave us that was in red, and we're like, what the hell are we going to do? Yeah. We have to, like, park it and, like, Uber over, like,
Crenshaw.
Yeah.
Nipsey's super cool. They don't care. Nipsey will wear all red one day, but he's super.
But he's Nipsey. Know? Like,
yeah. Yeah, that's so
it's
funny.
It's not him you have to worry about.
I went to one of Nipsey's parties with one of my homeboys and stuff, and it was like a party. It was like his party and stuff, and I'm cool with Nipsey. And I went to the section to say, what up? And I didn't realize my friend was wearing red from head to. He was from Flint. He was like coming to LA to visit. And I wouldn't think. And I walked to Nipsey's section with him, you know, this show him love. He just kind of looked, and all his boys was straight on one about to go. And I looked like, what's wrong? I saw my boy. I was like, yo, go over there. I'm talking about he had red shoes and a hat. I said, go over there at the bar. You about to get tore.
Your friend
up.
Also thought, like, I'm killing it tonight.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. He did. I think he worried that. He was like, ooh, you know, from Flint. You know, he like, yo, I'm doing it tonight. I'm like, bro.
That's that Flint style.
They almost got us murked.
So did you have a music internship or anything down there? Like,
yo,
how did you?
So, man, I was striking out for 4 years straight, bro. Like,
who,
to the point.
Who let you down?
Man.
Yeah, talk about it.
DJ Sense, my bro from the affiliates, you know, because Drama and Cannon start blowing up.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were friends, but not that they were, you know, fire. And I was still like little, so they weren't, they, you know, I would get them on the phone here and there, but they was like, this is after a motherfucker Cannon had the Lil Wayne Cannon song. He was on fire. Cannon was on fire. And Drama was just out of here. So Sense was the one that I could really be able to get a hold of. And Sense was just like having, just running me around in circles trying to get the mean and stuff. Shout out DJ Sense. We talk about that all the time and laugh about it. I tried to get in that Grand Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
But I never, not like T.I. I knew, but I couldn't get in CTE, even though they love me over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, they just ran a different tight ship over there.
What do you wear to a job interview?
I mean,
all red.
Yeah.
Yo, man. I would try to stay in the middle, like a button-up shirt and some jeans.
Yeah.
And just keep it, like, casual.
Did you understand that, like, part of that was to run around and get coffee and, like, do everything that they didn't want
to
do?
I was willing to do whatever it took to, like, accomplish my goal and my dream, man.
So who gave you your first opportunity?
So I was throwing parties my senior year, and it was this girl. She was like a freshman at Clark Atlanta, and she was like the baddest freshman, you know what I'm saying? And she was like, yo, I want to come to your parties. I heard you throw the dope party. By then, I was doing like the biggest parties on like the AUC. So she's like, I want to come to your parties and stuff. So I started picking her and her girls up before we go party, let them come, because it was 18 and up. Mm-hmm. And we would all be hanging out, and we developed a friendship, and she'd start asking me questions like, oh, you always listen to different music. And I was like managing producers on my campus. She's like, why you listening to beats? I'm like, I'm just trying to, you know, get a placement for my artist, I mean my producer and stuff like that. And she was like, oh, what, you just go meet my uncle? I'm like, who's your uncle? And she's like, Shakir Stewart.
Yo.
I'm like, for real? She's like, yeah. She's like, I'll take you to meet on Friday. So I'm thinking she's bluffing, you know what I'm saying? Friday came, she was like, you ready to go? I'm like, yeah. She took me straight to Shakira's office, and he sat down with me. We talked for an hour, and he offered me an internship on the spot.
Crazy. Wow.
Shout out to Nazila. She always says I don't be giving her enough credit. She says she changed my life, and every time I see her, she says she need that
she
bag.
She did. She
and deserves
your
aunt. The bag.
Like, yeah.
She got me in. And she told me, too. Her story, too, was like, out of you and one other person, I decided you the last day, because he was telling her to bring me somebody from college, because he went to Morehouse from AUC that I could train, because I'm looking for interns. And she was like, I was going to pick one up, but I decided you the last day. I'm like, damn, thank you.
So what did you know about Shake?
I just know at the time that he signed Jeezy.
Yeah.
And that he was really in with L.A. Reid, and he was like a big part of what was going on in the Atlanta music scene at the time.
So you go in there, and you're an intern, and what does he have you do?
So he had like 8 boxes of demos. This one, CDs is still like the thing. So he was like, listen, man, I need you to listen to all these demos. And he's back and forth to New York. And I had to like log everything in, write feedback and like all this stuff. And he was like, when I get back, I need you to play me the hottest stuff from these boxes. So it started off like that. So I used to do that every day. So I'd be in there from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. listening to demos. You know what I'm saying?
Well, okay. Yeah. There's this idea, and I think anybody who watched like Fade to Black understand that maybe artists or producers or engineers or A&Rs will listen to 10 seconds, 15 seconds of a song. Was that you?
I was too nervous to do that, so I would listen to like everything. I didn't want to miss nothing, and I didn't know if it was a setup, like he put a gem in there, and even if I missed it, he was like, you're gone. Like, so I used to listen to everything, man. Like,
what a high pressure situation.
Yeah, it's just like, you're so nervous, you're like, this is my, I'm like listening to every song from top to bottom,
even
like,
if it was terrible,
man. Listen,
especially if it was terrible. I bet that 90% of it was not good.
Oh my god, 98.9 was horrible. You know, you just know off rip, but you just do it because it's like, I don't want to fuck up.
Is this all Atlanta based artists?
It's just, you know, people mail everything in, so it could be from anywhere.
Did you find any gems?
No, I did not. I did not find any gems, man. And, you know, after I finally listened to, I'm talking about, it might have took me like 6 months to listen to all these fucking demos.
Oh, my God.
And after that, I upgraded to being able to go into meetings with him and observe him do meetings. Then, you know, like, we got super cool. Then he started training my ear and, like, just teaching me the ropes and, you know, because he saw I was serious.
Yeah.
So now he started taking me more serious and training me.
Who was more serious, you or T.I.?
T.I. for sure.
T.I. So what's the first studio session he brings you to?
Well, I'm mostly, though, honestly, because he used to be back and forth to New York, his thing was, like, training me on the business side, mm-hmm. and he had a studio downstairs. So it would be people that come in, and Ross recorded his first 2 albums at Hitco in Atlanta, and I would just sneak in there until he kicks me out. And Ross kicked me out every day for, like, 3 months.
What would he say to you?
Get out.
It wasn't like
what you doing in here? Get out. And Gucci Pooch, like, come on, bro, you gotta get out. You know what I'm saying? And until, like, one day, man, I just, like, would do anything. Like, he was like, I remember saying, I need a vibe, man. I need some chicks. And I'm a promoter. I might have called 10 things to the joint. He's like, what is going on out here? He walked outside. I'm like, I don't know. He's chilling. And he's like, yo. You know what I'm saying? He's like, who's this kid? Then I told him what I did out those parties, man. And I remember asking, like, Ross, why don't you host my party? Because by this time, I'm doing, like, the bigger scale parties, like, mm-hmm. as the, like, lower promoter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he was like, how much? I might have said like, $2,500. And he just walked away. Like, he ain't even say nothing. He just looked at me like, boy, you crazy. And the funniest shit is he came to the party.
Really?
He didn't like, I didn't promote him or anything, but he came to check me out. He pulled up, made back. They like, Rick Ross out here. And Poochie was like, go get Dallas. And the promoters went and got me, and they let me walk him
Holy
in and
shit.
Stuff. Set him up at a table. He was super cool about it. And like,
that's awesome.
And he was like, yo, your party, you know, Ross, yo, I like this beachy. You know what I'm saying? Like, so that was dope.
That's awesome.
Was that like the best feeling for you?
Yeah, because it's like, you know, when you're a promoter, you bring the celebrity. It's like, you the man. So I was like, yeah, I got Ross. This is my damn hustling Ross. So you're like, oh, man, you got Rick Ross here from Miami? Like,
oh, my God.
So all the bigger promoters like, damn, how you pull that off? Like, you know.
Wait, do you have to run and tell the DJ, like, yo, Ross is coming in?
Yeah, you
in,
do all that. Yeah. Oh, you go crazy. Yeah. You running around. You got the chicks like, yeah, I got Ross. What you doing? You scrambling. You just feeling good.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What were the business aspects that you really picked up on from Shakir?
Man, Shakir was very, very good at his relationships. Relationships really important to him, making sure he was good on following up with people and making sure that everybody knew that he cared. And, you know, for
that's artists and
artists, managers, lawyers, everybody, people in the street niggas, the dope boys, because, you know, this is BMF era. So he had relationships with everybody. So he was just super just locked in with the city. He was New York. He was moving and shaking. And he was just incredible, like, person to learn from, because he was like the cool executive, but he still was working hard as fuck. He might be in the club till like 2, 3 a.m. and still at the office at 10 a.m., you know what I'm saying, working hard. So he was definitely a dope person to learn from.
And there's a lot of people out there who don't understand that part of the job is being in the clubs until 2 or 3 a.m. and like...
Shout out my girl. You hear this.
So when you're out at the clubs, like, what records really surprised you when you were like in the clubs down in Atlanta, like that
the Lil Jon explosion was in, like, what is going on? Like, crunk music was like, what the fuck is going on? And just to see like B.I., like, when that came, I was like, yo, who is this dude? This is crazy for someone's like somebody that doesn't really rap and make hits all day. That was crazy. Like, he was killing.
When do you actually formally get offered a job?
So, that's a good question. So, I interned for 2 years for free.
We only do good questions around here.
Yeah. And it was to the point where it was like, man, my mom was like, yo, he's not going to offer you a job. All my friends were like, yo, you're going to intern for free forever.
Isn't that funny when the people who aren't in the music industry feel like
telling
they know
me
it
what's
better.
Going on in the music industry? And
just check Twitter.
And Shakir was like super busy, man. Like, he was kept getting promoted, man. He signed Ross, and he was like A&R and Janet Jackson album. I got to meet Janet one day. I fanned out.
Whoa.
So not Big Sam,
just Janet.
But just
Jackson,
Janet. All right,
just Janet. And
what was that like?
It was, I mean, it was brief. It was just like, we were at JD's studio.
Was did,
A&R,
yeah. Did she tell you to get out?
I wasn't in the studio. I was in the, like, the walkway right to the studio. She just said, hi, I'm like, hi. And she said, Shakir, come here. I need to talk to you. Like, her voice is real low. Oh, my God, it's Janet Jackson. Lord have mercy. You know what I'm saying? And I just freaked out. But, yeah, that was crazy. So he had a group that he signed. And he was, like, kind of busy, too busy to, like, A&R and pay. So he was like, listen, I signed this group from L.A., four brothers. The group name was Brother. And he got them, like, a reality TV show, all this stuff. So he said, listen, if you deliver a single, I'm going to give you a job.
This is what he says to you.
Yeah. He was like, but if you don't deliver, then, you know, this is not going to happen. I'm with these guys every day. Today was my brother. You know what I'm saying? So we like in the studio, and you know, the guys were kind of like, you know, they were R&B, like, kind of chilling. Like, I ain't gonna say they weren't the coolest guys, but I'm not gonna disrespect them. But you know, I tried my best to, like, really just, you know, getting good with them. So finally, man, after like 2 or 3 months of just working with them, I'm talking about after like 30 records, man, I finally came up on the record. Black Elvis produced it, and he was like one of the, him, Drummer Boy, they were like some of the earlier producers that championed me and really like gave me good records as an intern. So he gave me the record and ended up being a single, and Shakir gave me a consulting position with him.
Crazy.
At Def Jam, and it was like the best day of my life. And it was like, he just got promoted to EVP after Jay-Z left.
Yeah.
And he gave me a job, and I was like, oh, this is dope.
So where are we in the time frame here? This is
2008.
And so you're out of college.
Out of college.
And still based in Atlanta?
Based in Atlanta. Shakir, so I was with Shakir. So 3 months after that, Shakir committed suicide.
Right.
So that was October 1st, 2008. And it was like, probably like a month and a half process of just everybody just like really just like what the fuck, and you know,
well,
just
where were you
going through the stages? I was when I found out the news, I was in Flint registering to vote because I was going to vote for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I could only go because I only had a Michigan ID, so I had to fly home, and I found out when I was home with my parents.
And now he is your mentor. He's your
a father figure because he's the only successful black person I know at the time that's like really, you know, yeah, successful, have his family. He just got everything like you would want as a young black man. Like, he had it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So he definitely was, like, everything. Just a mentor, father figure, everything. And it was just, like, a big loss for me. It was, like, very devastating.
And, well, how did you think that you would go forward?
I really didn't know what the future held for me, man. And it was, like, I didn't want to be too selfish and greedy just thinking about that at the time. So more so just mourning, just making sure everybody around them was cool. And, you know, just us just sticking together, just, you know, holding each other down. And L.A. Reid in November... At the end of November, because, you know, he was definitely really fucked up by this because it was like his son. So at the end of November, I think after Thanksgiving, it might have been like the first week of December, he called me up to New York. He gave me an interview, and I did good in the interview. And he said, I want you to come to the A&R meeting. And I came to an A&R meeting in December, and I had four, like, gems, like, shit that I know. Like I knew I had to play some shit.
Yeah.
And he's, like, the best records I ever got in my life, like, as far as, like, I went and, like, searched the city, like, to get these records, you know what I'm saying? And it was, like, a record from, like, Esther Dean before she popped. Wow. With Hit-Boy.
Yeah.
Hit-Boy and Chasing Cash was, like, my bros, because they were working under Polo in Atlanta.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what they call it? Surf school?
Surf club.
Surf club, yeah, yeah.
So they were just lacing me. He, Drummer Boy, lacing me with Heat. And like all these people, man. And I went in there and like I killed the A&R meeting. And that night Karen Kwok called me like, LA want to hire you. What you thinking you want to make? And we just discussed like whatever, you know, our terms was. And I was in the Def Jam building.
Well, who were the other A&Rs in Def Jam at that point,
man? Do you understand, like, as it was like a rookie playing for the Lakers, the Yankees. Like, I'll go in there and you got Tricky and Dream.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
DJ Khaled.
Oh my god.
Lenny S.
Yeah.
Boo.
Oh my god.
Man, who else is there? You got Angelo Sanders. Man, it was like laced with like, so you're sitting there in the A&R meeting, you got like, imagine playing music after Khaled in an A&R meeting your first year. And Khaled is Khaled.
Yeah.
So you're going in there like, you don't even want to play. They like, when the they like, who wants to ask Nick? I'm like, yo, I'm trying to stretch through something. Like, Khaled just played like 10 hits in a row. Get me out of here.
Did you like trying to match his enthusiasm?
No, you can't match no Khaled enthusiasm, man. You just got to go over there humble, man, for real.
What's the best thing that Khaled said in a meeting?
What you mean? Like, Khaled says a million best things in one meeting. Like, you know what I'm saying? He made everybody put their hands up in the meeting. He like, LA, I'm about to change your life with it. Like, he says whatever. Like, Khaled's the greatest. You know that.
When
it comes to the talk.
Eric and I were sitting in Sav's office one time.
Yeah. When he was working at Def Jam.
Yeah. And Khaled comes in and he goes, and Sav had like lost like a bunch of weight or whatever. And so Khaled goes over to me and says, yo, where do I get one of those slim fitting t-shirts? Just like, what does that mean?
Yeah. So Def Jam has this legacy. They have this huge roster of artists.
Yes.
And all these A&Rs
crazy.
Have all the biggest artists.
Crazy.
Who did they assign you?
Joel Santana.
Ooh. Oh, man.
And, you know, me being young, I'm green. I'm like, yeah, I love you. Joel's, you crazy. Of course. They not telling me Joel's ain't turned in an album in 4 years for them, and they can't get him on the phone and all this stuff. So I'm like, yeah, cool. Joel's, let's do it. So, like, Karen's like, I'm a co-A&R with you. So halfway through, she like, oh, it was just you. Like, you, I wasn't co. It was, but, nah, you know what was so great, though, man? Joel's let me in. Like, he let me, like, work with him, man.
So,
like,
you made that phone call, and
Chubby Baby.
Yeah.
Shout out to Chubby Baby in Atlanta, who now works for Epic.
Mm-hmm.
He came from, like, the Dipset cloth, you know what I'm saying? And he was really tight. And he saw me coming up. He moved to Atlanta, and he saw me coming up, and he made the call to Joel's. Like, I believe in the kid. He's dope. Let him come to the studio. And I met Joel's and his brother Twin.
Yeah.
And Twin was like the one that really kind of like embraced me in the beginning, like to kind of like, you know, really check my stats or whatever. And he let me like work with Joel's.
Well, what does that mean to work with Juelz when he's not turning in, like...
So he had a studio. He was definitely going to the studio every day, but it was more so
it was
that
his own studio in Jersey,
it was
right?
his own studio in Jersey. And Juelz was just like, you know, it, me understanding the game now, he just was in a weird space. Like, so at the time, he wanted to really promote his Skull Gang squad. Mm-hmm. So he was really trying to put his team on because he came from, you know, the Dipset shit where it was like they did group shit, then they all broke off and did their thing. So he was trying to make it a group effort first, opposed to putting out his stuff. So, you know, that first year it was like a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of lessons learned. But we definitely, you know, got a chance to work and do some records together. Like back to the crib, mixing up the medicine,
wow,
and all this stuff, and
those are still great records, by the way.
Yeah. Oh man, like, and it was like,
did you make?
He,
that?
By the way, he was one of my favorite rappers.
Yeah.
To this day, like we still, whenever I see him, it's love. Like he's incredible. Well, you know,
how did Back to the Crib happen? Did you
Relationship with Polo and Chubby.
Yep.
We went down to Atlanta, and we went to Polo, and Polo played it. Like Esther Dean did the hook originally.
And did you know Chris?
Chris was cool with him and Juelz already had a relationship. Mm-hmm. So more so was like just telling him we should do Chris. And he like, of course we should do Chris. And but
They had done Run It by that point, right?
Yeah, he did Run It. They were already friends. They were like tight. Yeah. And you know, because Chris lived in Harlem for a long time where he was developing as an artist or something.
Mm-hmm.
So the crazy story about this is, so this is us putting Chris on the record 3 months after the Rihanna thing.
Yeah. Right?
So he's in Orlando in a compound, like, where, like, nobody, no media, no nothing.
Right.
He just is down there just, like, letting them regroup and get all the stuff together. So Juelz gets him on the phone. He, like, come down to Orlando. So we all jump on a flight. We go to Orlando, and Chris had a relationship with Esther Dean. So he's like, oh, yeah, I knocked this out right now. He went straight in the booth and knocked it out. I'm like, oh, my God, this is crazy. Like,
by the way, that's a questionable term, by the way. Knock that
knock
out.
Knock that out. Yeah.
So he did the hook. Juelz laced the verses when we got back to New York. Then we went to play it for Def Jam. And before we played it, Juelz gave like a speech to LA, like, listen, you know, I know there's stuff going on with, you know, just like, you know, really try to like give him a little game on why he did it. Like, I just want you to respect my vision. He heard the record and LA was like, okay, I'm a, you know, really take what you said and like, you know, think about it, because it was like a big deal. Rihanna's the biggest selling artist on Def Jam.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's not just the easiest thing for LA just be like, go ahead, we're gonna promote Juelz Chris Brown record right after you just, you know, all this stuff went down with Rihanna. So we got a call like 3 days later, and Karen Kwok was like, you gotta take him off the record or we can't work it here. And Juelz was just like, he understood. But it went from getting him motivated and he excited, he has a hit record, and he kind of was like, nah, I'm still doing it. We're going to put this out, you know. So he kind of bucked against the system. And me, I'm lower level A&R, so I can't move the building. I don't know what's going on. I don't even know if a person is working one of our records. They could tell me they was working a record that impacted. I'd be like, yeah, I wouldn't know nothing. So we moved forward anyways. He basically was like, L.A., man, please, you know, like, play, you know, pleaded to him to let him just do this. And I guess L.A. agreed, but L.A. never worked the record. So me and Juelz, like, at the time, I feel like he didn't know the business side like that either.
Right.
So they're telling us they're working a record, and nothing's happening with the record. So we're like, damn, this ain't a hit. You know what I'm saying? And people in the streets like, yo, that record is fire. You know what I'm saying? So they gave us money to shoot a video. And we shot the video, and it just wasn't being worked, man. And Juelz went back into a shell. Like, well,
that's when
I'm not,
feed it to Best of Both Offices and give it to the.
Yeah. I didn't know nobody. I didn't have no relationships with New York like that. The first time me coming to New York was getting this job, so I didn't have no relationships. I didn't know nothing. I was coming here. I was staying in a hotel or being in a studio because I really didn't have no relationships like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So where do you go from there?
So
Juelz gets down.
Juelz doesn't turn in the album, and I get fired from Def Jam.
Fired because you
didn't turn in the album.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's like,
thanks, Juelz.
Yeah. Thank you, Juelz. Thank you. Nah, Juelz, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Shout out, Juelz.
Well, did Juelz ever give you any, like, bandanas?
Nah, Juelz is always cool, man. Juelz looked out for me, man. He was like, he was a great person, man. I can't say nothing negative about the guy. Still one of my favorite rappers. Just a good all around dude. Great family, man. Him and Twin, man. They showed me a lot about that side of life too. You know what I'm saying? Just being in the business and being able to hold down your family. Like they super serious about family.
So by the way, we're definitely trying to get Juelz on the podcast.
Yeah, and we've been in touch with Twin, and we're gonna make that happen. So you're 20 something.
Yep, 24.
You're 24.
24. You're no longer allowed at 825 Worldwide Plaza.
That's like a sick feeling. Like you're like on top. You're flying from New York every other week, from Atlanta, you know. And it's like you're in New York. You're in Def Jam. You got Jay-Z posters on. You're like, ooh, I'm part of like the real fabric of like the hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Like the shit. And now you're like back in Atlanta.
Yeah.
As the regular guy.
Did you tell your parents right away?
Yeah, I told everybody. I was devastated, bro. Yeah. I told everybody.
Where do you go from there? What do you do?
So,
did you start working at TCBY?
doing
frozen yogurt?
I definitely was like, listen, I know I'm good at this. Like, I knew in my heart I was good, you know, and I was like, I'm going to stick with it. So I would stay in the studio with all the producers that I had relations with. I let them know what was going on. And they all let me be around, and I just stay connected to like certain people that had the heat, you know. So Ethiopia, shout out Ethiopia, I love you. You're the shit. Used to be, she was the head of Universal Music Publishing, and she was the publisher for Chase and Cash, Hit Boy, all these people.
Now she's at Motown.
She's at Motown. So she's still at Universal too. She runs both companies.
Mm-hmm.
So. She used to always see me around, and she knew I was intern. She knew everything about me. She was like, yo, do you have a job? I'm like, no. She's like, okay, you're always around. Just come meet with me in L.A. So I'm like, are you, like, what's up? She was like, well, whenever you're in L.A., just stop by the office. So I just flew out there. Like, I got, like, I'm down to, like, my last probably $1,500. So I shoot out to L.A. Angelo Sanders lets me, you know, sleep at the house in, like, the basement and shit. So I go meet with Ethiopia. She's like, do you want to do publishing? Because I felt like you were more like, I'm like, yo, I just want to get back in the game. I just want to get my foot back in here. She's like, cool. All right. So she really liked me. She's like, all right, I'm going to introduce you to my boss. So I had a meeting with the boss, right? Then I flew back to Atlanta. Then his boss wanted to meet me. So I had they're not flying me out. So I'm going back to L.A. on my own dime. Just
and
like
you're just like watching grinding. Your bank account.
Yeah,
like,
oh, just dwindled. Yeah. Just nothing. Not getting haircuts or nothing. So I went and met with their boss. We had a meeting. And he was like, okay, cool. I want to hire you. So I'm like, great. So I go back to Atlanta. And I'm waiting for the offer to come in, and it's crickets. I can't get Ethiopia on the phone, nobody. So she calls me 2 weeks later, like, we gave the position to somebody in L.A. because we didn't want to relocate. They didn't want to relocate you.
Oh.
So I'm crushed. Like, oh, man, like, I'm striking out again, you know? And I was mad at Ethiopia. Like, damn, how you do me like this? You know what I'm saying? And I went to, like, a little depression, man, to be honest. I was, like, sad. Like,
yeah.
Every day, like, kind of moping. Then, Ethiopia, like a month later, Ethiopia called me. She said, I got something for you. I'm like, what's up? She said, I want you to meet Joey IE. He's rebuilding Urban at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And I want you to sit down with him when he comes to Atlanta. And Joey flies to Atlanta. I go meet him at the St. Regis. First time meeting Joey IE. Super poker face.
Yeah.
Go and sit down with him. He interviews me for like 30 minutes over lunch. He was like, all right, nice to meet you. So I leave the meeting. She's like, what you think? I'm like, man, that nigga don't like me. I'm like, I ain't going to get that job. Man, a week later, Joey calls me and is like, yo, I want you to come meet Todd Moskowitz in L.A. I'm about to fly you out. Boom, boom. I go to L.A., nervous as shit, not ready to strike out again. And Todd comes in the meeting. He's like, I don't know nothing about you. Apparently, Joey likes you. So I guess you're hired. So we talk
so
for like,
Todd.
We talk for a little bit more. And I go back. This is like at the end of that year. So this is like around November again and stuff. So then they call me. They're like, we're going to hire you. You can start in January. And we're going to have you live in L.A. for a month. In corporate housing so you can learn the ropes of the company. And that was me getting hired at Warner Brothers.
Okay. Who's on Warner Brothers at the time that you start working there?
Oh, man. It was like nobody there for real. You had Kirk O'Bangs.
Right.
Yep.
I want to say Currency was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Gucci Mane was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But his single was out.
But a single might have been out. I'm not
Gucci time.
It was nothing going on that year. It was 2011. at this time. Because I was at Def Jam 2009, 2010. I had no job, and I started back in the industry 2011.
Right.
And the first day on the job, I'm in Joey's office. And this is when Ross started doing the vlogs. So we're on the internet. I'm like, yo, Ross killing it with these vlogs. He's like, yeah. And, you know, Joey, like, shows some interest. He's like, yeah, I've been, you know, trying to chop it up with him or something. It's like a quick brief, like, just about Ross. So first thing I do, I call Gucci Poochie. Yo, Pooch, what up? He like, you talking? I'm like, yeah, I'm talking to him right now. Like, he doesn't know how tight. Like, you know, you could go in the meeting and say, I know all these people.
Yeah.
You know, in the music, everybody says that. So I'm on the phone with Poochie. They first, Rick, what's up, little bro? Like, Pooch, man, where Ross at? Like, he right here. I said, yo, tell Ross that I just got this job at Warner Brothers and we should bring Maybach over here. There's nothing over here. Let's do it. Hold on, let me get Ross. Let me go get Ross. Ross get on the phone. He's like, Who you over there? I'm like, Joey IE, I'm at Warner, bro. He's like, y'all come to my show Saturday in Toronto. Click. So I'm like, Joey said we could go to Toronto on Saturday. He like, for real? He like that fast? It was like Thursday. You know what I'm saying? So me and Joey flew to Toronto. Boom, we fly to Toronto, man. And we in the lobby of the hotel, and Ross walks in, and he sees me, like, giving her, like, yo, Joey, this is my guy. This is my guy. One of those guys. This is my guy. You know what I'm saying? And that was, like, the first start of negotiations for Maybach Music.
Did you have any idea of what the label would look like?
No. So I definitely was taking a chance because I knew Ross's worth ethic, and I know that he always had an ear, and he was, like, dope. You know, like, one of my favorite rappers, too. But he was still at the stage of career. People were like, if he makes a whack album, it's over. You know, like the same bullshit industry shit.
Yeah.
If he does something, like, this might not be a good idea. So we still went through that. You know what I'm saying? But I definitely knew that Ross was up to something. And I believed in him. He believed in me, and I believed in him.
Yeah. So what was the original, like, blueprint for MMG? Like, in terms of...
It was just Wale.
Just Wale?
He had Wale. And that was it. And he was making moves. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, he still had Gunplay, all the people, like... So
Triple C's.
He just had like all, like, he was always connected to people. So it was like he was talking about stuff he wanted to do in the meeting, but nobody knew it was gonna take off like this.
No, listen, 2017, everyone looks at it like, ah, a lot of wins right there.
Yeah.
But back then,
yeah,
Wale got dropped from Interscope.
Yeah. Meek Mill is unheard of
to
most people from outside of Philly.
Right. No one knew about Pill.
Nobody knew about Pill.
And Ross was not Ross like we know him today.
Yeah.
So
this is before Rich Forever.
So people in the building probably might not be supportive of this, right?
They're not. It's like 50-50 from everybody outside of like Joey and Todd.
So how'd you sell them on the vision?
I didn't care. I really didn't, man, because I know one thing about this music business. Everybody not going to support your vision, and you got to stick to your guns, and you got to fall on your sword in this game.
How did you convince both parties that this was gonna be it?
I knew that if I had to work with a whack artist, I was going to get fired out this year. So I was just I wanted Ross to be part. I knew whatever Ross was going to be a part of, we was going to be successful. And Joey was on the same mission with that. Like, Joey always was believed, of course, because he was, like, in it with me. And Todd was down. Todd is one of those people, man, if you're passionate about something, he going to let you rock. And that's one thing I always loved about Todd. He's never going to – if you're passionate, he's not going to keep, like, asking you questions or debating with you. He's going to be like, okay, all right, let's do it. So – and this is when Lior still was running Warner Music Group, too. So it was just, like, a good time, man, like, for this to happen.
How did you end up finding, like, Meek? How did you end up finding Pill? How did you end up...
So, Pill was already on the label.
Mm-hmm.
And Meek was already, like, in negotiations with Ross. So, it was more so just, like, letting the building know, like, no, this kid is dope. You know what I'm saying? And, like, really just making sure that everything goes through and pushing everybody. Because Wale was the first artist that came off the label. So, Meek was still not a big deal until after we dropped this first self-made project.
Yeah, well, all right. So, talk about Tupac Back.
Yes.
And talk about I'm a Boss.
So, Self-Made was the first project that we did when we did the deal. So Ross comes in, does a big presentation. Everybody comes in, and we play the music. So these records are already pretty much done before they even came into the building. So he comes in, and he played. I'm a Boss was probably out like 2 months by then, but it was like low-level like type out. And he wanted to go with Tupac Back first. So Tupac Back was the first record we went out with.
Right.
We did... What is it? Pandemonium. we did Pandemonium was one of the first records, and Tupac Beck.
Yeah.
And Wale had the record with Jeremiah. Mm-hmm. So those were like the first set of records we went out with, man. And we dropped that song and the shit just exploded, bro. Like, it was the fastest like shit I've ever seen. Like, just like going from like just being cool in the game to like the hot new niggas, like, so fast.
Yeah.
Wait, where was BMF at this point?
BMF was out already, like, because Ross had, because he had the mixtape. That mixtape came out probably like a year before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was when I was out the gang, because I was like, "Ooh, Ross, all this stuff," and you know, so it was like a year. So it was after BMF, before Rich Forever.
And what did Spiff TV play any part of this process?
Spiff was a big part of the MMG shit, man. Like, especially with Ross, because he was like more so like Ross's A&R, you know. So he was with Ross everywhere he went. So he was responsible for BMF and MC Hammer, because he found Lex Luger, or he was like the first one to get Lex Luger beats.
Right.
Yeah. So Spiff always been incredible with like finding beats and shit, you know what I'm saying? I more so played a role in all the artists on MMG,
right?
So
for that first project, it was basically Ross, Meek, Pill, and Wale.
Yes.
Then not long after, Pill left.
Yeah.
What happened?
I mean, honestly, man, I feel like Pill, it's hard to say, you know, like it just, he wasn't connecting, and I guess his relationships with everybody wasn't the greatest, and it's just a certain level of professionalism you got to have in this business to be successful. So it just didn't work out.
But
it wasn't my decision. I was too low on the totem pole at that time to like make a decision like that. So it was more so.
In terms of like how you're going to split up your time.
Well, it was easy at the time because we all had the focus. Like, the first, we were pushing Wale first. So Meek was just doing his shit in Philly, just making, you know, whatever he would do, making records, just doing what he's doing and shows. He was getting shows now. So he was just getting his bag up. So me and Wale went to Atlanta, and we started working on Ambition. And we did that at the same studio where I used to be at with Hit-Boy and Chase and Polo. We got Polo's room, and we did Ambition in that room.
Crazy.
And this is 3 months of every day together, like working out together, going eating lunch and dinner together with the crew. Like, we was together every day. Pause. Like, it was just too crazy.
Well, what do you like became Wale?
Yeah, you had to, because like when you know I wanted to be, I couldn't fly. If you messed this one up on MMG, Joey, Todd, Ross, and my, you out of here, bro. We gave you a real chance.
Yeah,
and so we was together every day, man. And
how'd that Ambition record come about with Meek and Ross?
That was me. That was me. So T-Minus did the beat. So I was getting beats from like all, like, Boy Wonder was my favorite producer, and T-Minus, all them. So T-Minus gave me a batch of beats, and I remember playing that shit for Wale, and he said, "Ooh, that's hard." You know what I'm saying? And this is so he was like, he just said, "They gonna love me for my aunt." I remember saying that. He just went in the booth and he started knocking that out. You know what I'm saying? So this is my first, this is our first record like we doing together with Ambition. So I'm like, "Ooh, this is gonna be great." Like, that's how we starting off. Then I remember being like, he like, "We should with Meek on this joint." We sent Meek sent us the verse. Like, we like, "What? This is crazy." Oh my God. Yo, that shit was amazing, man. That history was so crazy, man.
How do you decide who gets first, who gets last, who's in the middle?
As far as what?
Placement on the record.
Oh, I mean, how Meek came in on that song, you had to put Meek first. And it was kind of like Wale, we wanted to have different stuff because Wale was obviously on every song. So we wanted to have like other rappers kind of start off with songs to make the whole album sound like super just dope. You just don't want to hear Wale come in on every song first.
Right,
you
know? Right.
So it's more so that kind
of
thing.
Hey guys, we just want to take a second out to bring you a word from our sponsor.
Today's episode of A Waste of Time is brought to you by the new Spotify original podcast, Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty.
Hosted by Reggie Osei, a.k.a. Combat Jack, co-founder of the Loudspeakers Network, Mogul tells the story of the music executive who changed hip-hop and shaped the careers of some of its most beloved artists like LL Cool J, Missy Elliott, 50 Cent, Nas, Diddy, and so many more.
With one of the most illustrious careers in music, Chris Lighty rose to the pinnacle of musical success before an untimely end.
This story is more than just music, it's the story of the American dream. Mogul. The Life and Death of Chris Lighty is a Spotify original podcast produced by Gimlet Media and the Loudspeakers Network. Follow and listen to Mogul every week exclusively on Spotify.
And by the way, Jeff, I have listened to every episode of this, and I think, and this is not because we're Loudspeakers Network, this is not because we know Combat Jack, I just want to say, this is done so extremely well. Like, to the point, we had a meeting with Lior Cohen last week, and in the meeting we were talking to him about it, and he said that he hasn't had a chance to listen to the first four episodes yet because it's, you know, it hits very close to home. We listened to part of the Warren G episode
with Lior.
With Lior, the rice pilaf episode, and he was so taken by it. So that's somebody who knew the story, and we got to listen to the story with him, and it was pretty exceptional. Honestly, go check out Mogul. It's on Spotify right now. Four episodes so far. Another one comes out this week. It's gripping. It's amazing. It's sad to think what could have been, but an amazing story regardless. Mogul is up right now on Spotify. Shout out to everyone over there.
And now back to our podcast with Dallas Martin. We were hanging out last night.
Yeah.
And you told us about Lotus Flower Bomb and how, like, working that at radio.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing story, so you have to tell it now.
So, basically, we got, like, a lot of street heat going from the Sell Made project. So, Wale's in the street, all these records out, and they're like, yo, Wale's trying to change his sound for MMG. He's trying to be, I'm like, yo, we got to make something for the ladies, you know what I'm saying? And Wale, like, we used to have mad chicks in our sessions, like, so we always was on the same tip.
I mean, this is down in Atlanta.
Yeah. I was a promoter. Yeah, now I'm an A&R, MMG. So this is lit now. Yeah. We talking about every day is like a real like situation.
Oh, my God.
So, man, he had like this dude. We had the beat, and one of his like writers that there every day, he like kind of like pinned the hook. And we had it for like a month, then we kept revisiting, like, yo, that shit sound like something. And he's like, yeah, something, like, Wale, because he's very smart with the music. Like, that nigga's incredible when it comes to, like, making records. I learned a lot from Wale,
mm-hmm.
for sure. So he did the verses, and he's like, who should we put on here? He was like, Miguel. Miguel was on fire around this time. So we reached out to Miguel. He on fire for us, so he kind of curving us because we're not proven yet. You know what I'm saying? So finally, we get him on there. So Miguel, we send it to him, right? Miguel sends us the shit back different from the way it is. It don't sound as good. So we like, damn, why he changed it? So we sitting there like, damn. So we like pressing the gun to turn it in the album. And I'm like, Wale, man, Wale, he's stressing. Like, we talking, like, he like, bro, this shit don't sound like a hit no more, man. And I'm like, damn, it don't sound as good. So he's like, fuck that. I'm about to run up on his show. Like, he in a show in Atlanta tomorrow. Like, fuck it. So he goes to the show, and he's like, Miguel, please, man, you got to do this shit how we did it. Like, please believe in me, bro. Like, we got it the right way. So Miguel comes to the studio the next day.
Yo.
And does the hook again the way we, the way the dude wrote it. Sam Dude wrote the hook.
Yeah, yeah.
So Sam Dude, we're all in the studio. And he does it. We're like, yes. Like, we knew it was a hit. You know what I'm saying? And we sat there, me, Wale, his engineer, K Diddy, and we had to edit it because it's like two parts. That first part of the song was the bridge. So we edited it. I pushed that shit up to the beginning so it could be like a different part. Then we like changed the shit around. So we edited it and we got it right. And we turned the album in. We like, yo, this is the single. And Joey's like, this ain't gonna work at radio. This is too slow. You know what I'm saying? It was slow. So it ain't on Joey. I was like, yeah, but it's gonna work, man. He's like, nah, you gotta speed that shit up. We like, speed it up. So he like, what? So he like, yeah, you gotta go up. Like, we had to go up on like 5 or 6 BPMs or something. He like, oh man. Like, so Wale's like, nah, you can't do that. I sound like a chipmunk now. So he like, nah, this is what we doing. So we speed it up. And it didn't take too much away from the song, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? But as an artist, you feel it. You know what I'm saying? Like, the general public would never know. And that shit, I think that shit went to number one in like 2 weeks, man. And we was like super on fire, man. Then we're like, Joe, we told you. So let us put the regular version on the album. And we got to put the regular version of the song on the album.
Yo, how much are you afraid of getting caught up in the studio after listening to something for 3 months and being like,
demo-itis.
Yo, it sounds great to me. And then you play it for someone with fresh ears and they're like, no, this isn't it.
I played Lotus Flower Bomb for girls. I played Bad for people, and they were like, So I never get caught up in.
They were like, whatever?
They were like, well, I played it for girl. I was so hype. I'm in my living room in the crib. I'm like, yo, y'all want to hear Wale's single? You hype. You know what I'm saying? It's your first project, your first single. And I played it. The girl like, that's all right. I'm like, for real? You know I'm feeling in your heart. Like, no, this is a hit. She like, it's cool. Like, what else y'all got? Like,
did you tell her to get out?
Yeah.
Wait,
do you test them out too? Do you go to the clubs with the records and try?
Nah,
them out?
I never really go that far with it.
Yeah, but yeah.
You doing more internal stuff with your friends and like people that you trust their ear and stuff, and you play it for people that just like are super just into music like you.
How much did that record sell?
Man,
like first week?
It's definitely, I don't know what it did first week, but I know it's a platinum record.
Yeah.
For sure. And I know it was the record that changed both of our lives, because we went from like Wale being on the fence to being a star to turning them into a star.
Crazy.
For sure.
Crazy. And you now know? You're solidified at this
point. Yeah. Wale does 167 first week after he did 32,000 total on his last album.
So, shout out to Interscope.
Shout out to Lady Gaga.
Hey, Lady Gaga.
Does Miguel fuck with the song, the new version?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just making sure.
It was a hit. He's like, oh, you guys, it was my idea.
So then it's Meek's turn.
It's Meek's turn.
So Dream Chasers 2.
So listen, so Meek was like, yo, I want to record in L.A. I'm like, yes. You know what I'm saying? So this is like, so this is 2012, the beginning of 2012. So he's like, yo, but I got to stay in some fly shit. So I'm like combing the city for like corporate housing that has like, so I finally found this apartment complex that does corporate housing, had this penthouse. I'm like, yo, you like this drink? He's like, hell yeah. Meek like, hell yeah. So Meek already got the goes and everything. He ships his cars out. So Meek is on fire because that whole year he was doing shows.
Yeah.
So Meek is rich now. You know what I'm saying? Without
Tupac back and without, I'm a boss.
I'm a boss. He was going crazy the whole year. So he come out the whole bit like his Philly crew, his main people, like the five people that with him, Tupac, Coon, O'Malley.
Yeah.
Like, so.
They ship out the four-wheelers and all that?
Man, Meek, man, one thing about him, man, he can adapt to any city and make it feel like it's his, man. So his boy was K. Smith, Will Smith's nephew, and Will Smith owned Boom Boom Room in L.A., the studio. So we set up there, and we literally partied every day in the studio and made records. And I never seen nobody that could make an album with 50 people in the room drinking and smoking and just doing, and he just in the corner. And I never seen nobody like he like rapping just like in the corner. Like Meek used to rap to the wall.
Damn.
Like by himself in the corner. Like he was like, when you know, you'd be like, yo, go in timeout. That was Meek, like in the timeout, just writing records like in the wall. That was so crazy. I remember he used to do that all the time. He used to write the craziest shit, bro. And
what's the difference in terms of like recording times, like
Who records quick, like who thinks of ideas quicker, of anybody?
They're
energy?
Both they're I got spoiled because they both are super, they just work at different times. Like Wale would start at noon and finish at midnight, while Meek would start at midnight and end at noon.
So you never sleep.
So I'd be like, what the fuck, bro?
So this is a totally different recording situation for you.
Whole different, because now I'm a night person and I'm going to the office at like 1 p.m. Like,
also, do you have to figure out like his psyche now?
Yes.
You have to like understand who Meek is.
Yeah, because Wale is the type of person, he wants the producers to come in. We might make something from scratch and like put something together. And he's a big about like which producers and like kind of ambition. We had DJ Toop just come every day to be a part of like the vibe and help us. He was teaching us how to make records like for real all the way. You know, not saying he did Legendary, of course, but it was like, he was like, he believed in us, like, and he always believed in me, too. So he knew me for, like, I was intern. So he was like, he just loved our energy, and he just loved being a part of something fresh and new.
Yeah.
So he taught us a lot just about, like, the cohesiveness.
He's
and
criminally
put us,
unused.
Yeah,
like,
he's so
underused.
He's, like, one of the most underrated producers of all time. Shout out DJ Toomp. You're my boy, bro. Yeah. You're the shit.
So L.A.
L.A. But Meek's like a beat. Just give me a hot beat, and I'm going to do the rest. And you just had to, Meek might, like, you got to have 100 beats ready to go every session, because Meek is like the pickiest beat person I've ever met in my life. Next one. Okay, I like that one. And he'll do a verse. Next one. You know what I'm saying?
So are there any that he passed day. On that that became something for somebody else?
Yep.
Like
Mike Will gave me the beat for the 2 Chainz Drake stuff. What was the
No Lie?
I had No Lie. Meek passed it up. Meek.
Oh my God.
And Meek could be the first one. Give me some hits, bro. Give me some where the hits. Nigga, he be fresh. Meek ain't playing with you in the studio. Man, play me that shit, bro.
I'm playing.
I remember I interviewed him one time, and I asked him something about, like, you know, yelling, you know, and he was like, I don't yell too much, is that nobody else yells enough, or something like that. And I was like, that's a really good quote.
Yeah, I love that. And my thing, too, I just, like, it's like DMX to me. Like, yeah, he's passionate. Like, you feel one thing about Meek, you feel his music. Like, you connect to it. And he speaks from that voice that people don't get heard. You know what I'm saying? So, he's speaking for all the have-nots, bro. And you know what I'm saying? People that really came from nothing. Like, when you go visit where Meek's from and see how they came up and live and just, like, his family and his friends, like, they came up some real circumstances. Like, niggas was really doing shit, was in the streets at a young age, just trying to survive and, you know, being like the man of his house. His, like, father was, you know what I'm saying, killed. Like, it's a lot of stuff that he had to go through, you know. So that's just, like, the passion in him, you know.
And when does the building really get behind Meek?
Well, the building he was already on fire with, I'm a Boss was lit. So yeah, now it was like, don't fuck this one up. So it came off the pressure of LA. Then it was like, no, I'm lit. They like, nah, you fuck this one up, you out of here too. So we in the joint, man. And I remember I was giving him good beats. I was delivering. But he, Key Wayne, he was on Key Wayne before me because Big Sean, he liked some Big Sean. He's like, who's that producer?
Yeah.
And Key Wayne sent us the Amen beat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
So it was just like a church joint. It was no drums. So like dun dun dun.
Yeah.
So we like, yo, this shit hard, ain't no drums though. You know what I'm saying? Like the drums is like they ain't on point. So Jahlil Beats came in. He was like, ooh, that shit hard. So Jahlil put the drums on it like the way Meek like him. And Meek was like, hell yeah, that's it right there. So this nigga, we playing though. So it's a, you know, we had a part. It's a lot of bad bitches in the building. And Jeremiah was in there. He like, amen. Because Jeremiah wrote some of that with him.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So he, like, went in the booth. He, like, it's a lot of bad bitches in the building. Amen. And they was like, yo, that's just so hard. And he kept going. Then we was like, yo. So he ended up doing, like, the hook and the verse. And we like, yo, that shit fire. And Drake was really fucking with Meek at the time and shit. So he was like, yo, Drake. He was like, they were FaceTiming. Like, they was cool as fuck.
Right.
And he like, yo. He was like, I'm about to send you something, nigga. Let me know if you fuck with it. Drake like, hell yeah, this shit hard. I'm about to jump on this joint.
Yeah.
And Drake sent that verse. He like, oh, we got a massive hit, bro. Huge. So this is around the time, like, before streaming and stuff. So we had to do a mixtape because, you know, you feel like you have to do the mixtape to get hot the gear for the album.
Right, right.
But Dream Chaser 2, man, we would have just made that the album, bro. We had, like, Burn on this one.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. We had Amen. We had Travis Scott for the first time ever.
Yep.
We had, like, Kendrick Lamar for the first time. People knew who he was.
I mean, so, like, and that went on like Dat Piff and just did like platinum numbers. Like it was like crazy.
Yeah, for sure, man.
So then when it comes time to do the album.
So listen, so check this out. Check where we're going through this, right? So we dropped that in May on Meek's birthday, Dream Chasers 2.
Happy birthday.
2012.
Yeah.
He goes on tour with Drake. Lior Cohen calls me in the office with Todd and all them. Well, he's on speaker. Todd calls me, leaves on, yo, I need my album by September. I'm like, yo, he's about to, like, by the way, we just gave you all our gems.
Yeah, right. Like, there's no time like, to record.
Meek's going on tour, and I'm like, it's no way it's going to happen. He's like, no, you have to deliver an album by September, because they were trying to make some numbers for the quarter or something.
Right.
And I'm like, Todd is like going in on me, like, you better deliver this fucking album, you know what I'm saying? Or August, they need it by August. I'm like, it's no way he's going on tour from May to like the end of July. He was like, you better figure that shit out. So I'm like,
were you like ready to start rapping?
So I came up with the idea. I was like, all right, we're gonna get him a tour bus with a studio in
it. Yeah.
So we do the research and shit. So we get him this expensive ass bus with the studio in it, right? Yeah. And this nigga's on the road. He's doing road shit. He's doing shows, doing the after party.
Yep.
He's tired. And he's not recording on the bus. So we pay all this money. And this nigga don't record. Then you see like Insta or whatever. And it's like all the other niggas rapping on the tour. You're like, damn, this shit is going to be fucked up. So they like, I spent all this money. Bro, I was like, why the fuck would you spend all that? I'm like, yo, I had to turn it. So I'm like getting killed at all sides and shit. So then Meek gets off tour and shit. And he comes into the, he's like, all right, I mean, it's not going to be ready. Like, it ain't like, I'm not rushing for y'all. So then we still was kind of under pressure. So me and Meek went to Miami, and we had to like kind of rush the first album, man, Dreams and Nightmares, because we had to like crunch it, because we put it out on Halloween still.
Yeah.
So we had to make it from like, I want to say, the end of July. Like we got to work on August and September. And it wasn't enough time for us to make a great, great album. We still had dope records on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, and that was like, for the time span we had, I think we made an incredible drink, but we came off so much heat off of DC 2, and that took some time to make. It took us like, yeah, you know, some like 5 months to make that album.
So that intro.
That intro.
Like, we were at the listening party, which was at...
it was at the Electric...
Electric Lady.
Ladyland.
Yeah.
Right? And there were a lot of people there. Yeah. Jay was there.
Yes.
Will Smith was there.
Yeah.
Angie.
Angie was hosting it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A lot of people in the building. And that record played, and everyone knew that it was like something special.
Yeah.
All these years later, it's become like a staple at every New York party.
It's the best intro ever in hip hop history.
And I remember we went to Summer Jam one year, and Meek was not on the bill, but he showed up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he stood on one of the speakers, and this is like for MetLife Stadium.
Yep.
You know, not like the, and he just did the intro, and the place fucking blew up.
Yeah.
That intro is unbelievable. Did you know when he was recording it that it could be something this big?
Yes. So first, the first part of the intro, we were at Ross's house in Miami, and it's when he first got it, and he said, "B Bully just gave me this joint. It's gonna be the intro." And he rapped the first part, and he was like, "It wasn't no hold on, wait a minute, y'all thought I was finishing on there."
Yeah.
So he's like, "But I'm gonna have it was hit all him. I'm gonna have Beat Bully make a different part to the joint, and I'm gonna keep going." So we like, "All right, that's dope." You know what I'm saying? Like, you know. So then we start recording. We recorded the album in the Satay Hotel in Miami. Spent hella money, wrecked the place. We can't even go back there. So we're in the Satay, and Beat Bully finishes the beat and sends it in. And we like, "Ooh, this be hard." So this nigga Meek like finishes like the first part all the way. Then he was like, "Hold on, wait a minute. Y'all thought we was like, oh my." When I got the SMI, he just got a, "Y'all thought it was rented?" Yo, so we like, yo, so niggas in the studio fall out like, "Yo, this shit is like definitely we knew how crazy that was gonna be." We're like, "Man, that shit is so fire, bro." Like, we left that session like, "Man, that nigga just made, we were part of something special in there that night, man."
Yeah. Where was the first time you saw him perform it out?
I might have been at that
Summer Jam?
Summer Jam.
Man. Because that was like late May or something.
That was wild.
Yeah.
Wait, so I want to talk about...
Go ahead. Because it still wasn't the record we was pushing, so it kind of started bubbling.
Yeah. Right?
And it just became a staple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The intro to his follow-up, which must have been DC 3?
DC 3. I was back working on Wale's next album, The Gifted. So he did... we were in L.A., in Atlanta working on The Gifted, and it was a mixtape, so I kind of was like, "Yo, go ahead and knock that out." So I can't really speak for DC 3 like that, because it was a mixtape thing, and I was back on working on Wale shit.
I mean, I don't know if you ever heard the record, but I do remember that he not the mixtape. I'm saying I went to a listening, and the record had the mixtape had not been put out yet.
Okay.
And he was debating on how to open the mixtape. There was He had a record. He had an intro record, and he was going to go at everybody in the same way that, like, I guess it was after Kendrick's record.
Okay.
With, or Big Sean, rather. But he never put it out.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you had talked him out of it, or if anybody had talked him out of it.
Nah, that was all his decisions on DC 3, man. DC 3 was kind of a thing where I would just send him beats, and I was somewhere else working, and he was just like, because we was like a mixtape. We weren't, it was no pressure on that one, you know? It wasn't no pressure until after DC 3 was just like, and nigga was like, "Y'all can't fuck this up. This is the real deal over here."
Yeah.
And that's when that Dreams Worth More Than Money was like, that took a lot out of everybody, bro.
Yeah.
You got like, I'm talking about, imagine doing an album where Puff comes in the room, gives you a lecture. Irv Gotti comes in the room, gives you a lecture. Nicki Minaj comes in there like, "What's going on?" And you be like, "Oh, man, like, this is like a lot." You know what I'm saying? Because he was still like, people knew how good he was.
Mm-hmm.
And to a lot of people, we didn't come through with Dreams and Nightmares. We didn't deliver how we should have. So people are like, "Yo, y'all can't fuck this up, because he's really somebody, and you can't fuck this up." So again, your job's on the line.
I remember too, when Dreams and Nightmares dropped, that was Hurricane Sandy too.
Yeah, he caught a whole bunch of weird things happening. Like the whole East Coast was out, so people couldn't buy the music. Yeah. They couldn't go to the store.
A whole bunch of stuff hit at the wrong time.
Yeah. And he still did over 100.
Joey leaves. Joey goes to Def Jam.
Yeah, so Joey leaves before DC-3, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so basically, 2011, we had much incredible success. Then I want to say, damn, did Joey leave after the second year? No, he leaves after the first year. So after two, we have a lot of success. He leaves. He's like, oh, I'm out. I'm like, because, you know, I'm just coming off Chicago. I'm like, damn, everybody that I'll start working with, they dip on me. You know what I'm saying? So Joey's out. So I'm tighter than with Joey than Todd. Like, I don't really talk to Todd as much as I talk to Joey at this point. So I'm like, damn, what does it mean for me? Todd invites me to the house. And he's like, yo, I got you. Like, we're going to rock out next year. You know what I'm saying? He gives me a promotion. He doubles my salary because I was making some bullshit money.
Yeah.
He doubles my salary. Gives me a real contract. I didn't even have a contract at Warner Brothers at the time. It was just like a base salary type thing. And we fire you.
Yeah.
So he gives me a contract, my first contract. Puts me into six figures for the first time in my life. And he really changed my life, man. Like, for real, for real. And he gave me opportunity. I moved into Joey's office. And during that whole year, he, like, treated me like Joey. Not with the same, like, you know, level of status, but, like, he was training me. He was, like, yo, like, putting me in a real position to, like, really succeed with his company.
And talk about what Shari Bryant meant to your professional life.
Shari Bryant is my favorite person in the music business. By the way, me and Shari worked at Def Jam together.
Yeah.
So when I was there that year,
that Jewel's project.
Yeah, she was one of the people that still, she knew Jewel. She was from Harlem. Yeah. So she was like, don't worry, it's not you. Like, she always, like, motivated me. Then she was, like, even one of the people that vouched for me because she was at Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And she told Joey, like, nah, he's dope. You should get him. So, I mean, I heard about that later, but she definitely vouched for me. And that's probably one of the reasons I got that job as well. And, you know, she didn't have a relationship where she never worked a Ross project. So that was my relationship. But then she came in and she, like, fully, like, you know, just held it down because she's the shit. And they called her Baby Gangsta. you know, and she was just a marketing guru, man. Like, she was just on point. She's assertive. And she just always been, like, a big reason why I could say, this is a hit. Is this a hit, Dallas? Yep. Okay. And she'd go in the building when I'm not there and just cause a firestorm.
So you work on The Gifted.
Yes.
And that whole record is full of excellent music.
Yeah.
Including 88.
Yes, Just Blaze.
Just Blaze. How did that happen?
Wale, I'm going to tell this story because you're the funniest and I love you. So, so we get the Tone P did the original beat. It's like a sample in it. This shit is cool. I'm like, we listen to him. I'm like, yo, this shit hard. He like, yeah, but I want to add something to it. I'm like, who? He like, man, maybe Just Blaze and shit. So I call Just Blaze. You know what I'm saying? Like, Just, man, can we get in with you? Whatever. We go to his studio. It's like in Harlem.
Yeah, well, at the time.
Yeah, at the time. And, you know, we the biggest Just Blaze fans. Like, we're like super Just Blaze fans. So Just Blaze is like, all right, send me the stems. I'm going to fuck with it. You know what I'm saying? So when we go past. No record. 2 weeks go past. No record. 3 weeks go past. No record. So I'm like, Judge, you gonna give it? He like, yeah, I got you, man. Like, you know, he's so cool and calm.
Yeah.
I got you. When is the album turn? Yo, I got you. Man, so a month go past. He's sending the record, right? I'm like, oh, this shit is crazy. But Wale was so mad that he took so long. Nigga. He man, fuck this shit, man. This nigga, how I wanted it. He ain't listening. So Wale throws like the temper tantrum, not really about the song, just about he felt like you trying to play him because he took so long. So I'm like, Wale, this shit is amazing. No, we about to go over there and we gonna tell him that this he gonna change it. I'm like, I'm not going over there. So me and him start arguing in the studio. Why you ain't right? I'm like, bro, this shit dope. No, this shit ain't dope. You don't know what you talking about. So we in there arguing and shit. That shit was so funny, man.
What happens and how do you find out that Warner Brothers is gonna merge with Atlantic in terms of the rosters?
Yeah, that was a crazy day. So
you're living in L.A.
I'm living in L.A. now. Cause
you're situated.
I'm relocated. I'm there now because, like, when Joey left, Todd moved me to L.A., relocated me, paid for the relocation. Like, he just, well, like, really God, was like, you're about to be here.
Couldn't afford shit.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I was still off the base salary. I just got promoted and got some real money, so I really didn't have, like, he took care of everything.
Yeah.
So I'm out there. I still don't have a car. You know what I'm saying?
How are you getting around?
A rental. They gave me a rental, but I don't have, like, I'm still before I car. Even have yeah. my own car.
Yeah. Yeah. What were you driving? What kind of rental?
I talked to the lady at the rental place to give me that charger.
Oh, that was great. So still American made.
Yeah. So, yeah, man. So we went through 2012, Meek's album. Me and Todd built a strong relationship, man. And he said, he called me, man. It was like, the first week of December.
Oh, right.
And he's like, yo, I'm leaving. I'm like, what you mean? He said, I'm out. I'm gonna take care of you with your bonus and stuff, but you know, I'm out, man. You know, you did a good job this year, but I'm gonna go with Lee, or we're gonna do something. And I was just like, damn, okay, man, like, I understand and shit. He was like, but make sure, like, when the merger happens, you go over to Atlantic with Julian. So I was just like, okay. So me at the time, I was just frustrated, like, damn, now Joey, now Ty, like, can I catch a break, man? Like, I can't get in with nobody and just be like straight. So then I was just kind of like in a space where I was like, where should I go, man? Like, should I stay at Warner? And they're like, well, we're merging all the artists and the staff to Atlantic. But the people at Warner are like, well, you know, you could stay still. You know what I'm saying? But they don't know nothing about the music, the culture. And they're like, but we only want to sign R&B over here. And I'm like, what you mean? Like, how do you just only sign R&B? So, and it was crazy because right before Ty left, a month before that, he signs OVO.
Yeah.
So now we got Drake. So it was like, yo, like, the Warner was like the spot.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There's not too many things going on. Shit is moving because everybody is like cohesive, want to see each other win. We had like a really tight-knit family type thing. And it was crazy because it was like, it seemed like we were just like about to be the biggest label, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, K Michelle was signed. We just like did, like, we was doing a lot of dope and we were breaking artists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was like hard to do at the time because music wasn't still selling like that. And I remember like Julie calling me like, yo, I want to meet with you and Craig's going to come on to see you. And Craig came in, sold me on the Atlantic situation, and I was like, all right, cool, I'm rocking out with y'all.
Well, I mean, what was your relationship with them before?
I didn't have one. Never met them.
And so that first phone call, you were just like,
never met. I know who she was.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, you see her name like in bold and like a Billboard article.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But, yeah, but all, never your, had a all relationship. Your artists were coming over here.
I mean, we were all still part of, like, they didn't really know what was going on. It still was like, nobody was putting out an album that first 2 months. So it was just kind of like, nobody really knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. So do you retain all of your artists when you come over to Atlantic?
Yes.
Yeah.
I retain all of them.
And who did you pick up?
Nobody. I had all of them. Then I had K Michelle. And it was like more so of a situation like where they were like, K Michelle, what is this? And they're like, so I had K Michelle come up here and meet with the staff, and they end up liking her because I feel like there was like, we're not, because they were going to drop some of the acts coming over from Warner and, of course, keeping all the hot acts.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, cool. Like, we get it. And they kept K Michelle, and I did K Michelle's first two projects and stuff. So,
did you become her the same way that you became Wale and Meek?
No.
You have to learn.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Yo, there was video of her like a couple weeks ago running around this office
naked.
Like,
I mean, naked. Topless. Naked.
Yeah.
That's her. That's K Michelle. Yeah. Shout out K Michelle.
You know what's a great record, by the way? The record that she had, it was Ross featuring her, and they put it out as a single.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a great record. Like, yeah. I know it didn't like move as much as it should have.
Yeah.
Great record, though.
Yeah.
That was a good record.
I think Timberland produced that, too.
Oh, did he?
And Ross hit me like, I'm going to put your girl on, I'm going to give you some. Like, yo, so you know, Ross, I'm like, back. I'm like, good luck. I need this.
What changed, like, culturally between Warner Brothers and Atlantic for you?
It became like a situation where they were the only artists, and like all our artists were spoiled at Warner Brothers because they got so much attention from all the departments because it was not a lot of artists. So you got to understand, like, anytime something going on, you're going to have PR there. Like, everybody was there. So you go into a situation now where you're at a bigger, and it's like a lot of artists here. So it went from everybody just like micromanaged with attention to like, you know, you're a part of a big, like, pond of people now. So it's like everybody is not going to get the attention that they always received. And I feel like our artists were so spoiled. They, like, that shook them. Like, damn, what's up? Like, why everybody not at my show? Or, like, and it just became a situation where we all had to, like, realize, like, we're part of a bigger system.
Yeah. How does it feel like also, like, working with people? Like, you started with Wale and Meek in more, like, humble beginnings.
Yeah.
How does it change, like, when they become, like, you know,
diva status?
Yeah.
I mean, listen, man, if you got a good relationship with them, like, with your artists, and you work hard, they're going to fuck with you. But, of course, like, every artist, as they grow, they demand more, and they want more attention, more money, more success, and it just comes with it, man. You know, they're assholes sometimes, they're nice people sometimes, but you know, they're artists because they're passionate and they're crazy. You know what I'm saying? They're geniuses, and crazy is a thin line,
right?
So you're gonna get the genius cool side, you're gonna get the fucking crazy go crazy on your side.
Well,
so.
You certainly got the crazy side.
I got all the crazy ones,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
We asked Shari one time, we're just like, do you have to be like a psychologist? She's like,
yes.
Every day.
Yep.
How did that Post to Be record come about?
Oh man, Post to Be was dope because
that's a big record.
So Marion at the time was like, you know, we was coming off the MIA record and all that stuff. So people was like on the fence, like, okay, are we gonna believe in this new transition and stuff? So I had a good relationship with Mustard because the studio we recorded at in L.A. was the same studio that Mustard records. So he would come over to Meek Session all the time. And he was just always a cool, humble dude, just nice, man. And I remember, saying, like, yo, we got to get in. I want you to get in on the O. So, like, the first two sessions he had canceled. So I was like, oh, shit, like, this look bad. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want O thing. Like, he might just been busy or whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, the third time, I'm like, yo, like, bro, like, don't cancel this one. He's like, no, I'm going to be there. No, we at Windmark. I got you. So O went over there and shit, and I called Sam Hook. And I think Amaya bought one of his writers. And it was the first beat Mustard play.
Damn.
And O was like, yeah, you know, O, that's the way. You know, well, O, big on the, you know what I'm saying? So O was like, yeah. So O went in there. And, you know, him and his mans, they wrote the Post to Be, him and Sam Hook, and it's one other writer, I forgot his name, and they did the hook, and they did the first part. So then he was like, we got to get Chris on this. And I was like, that's going to be hard right now, right? Because Chris is like, it's just hard to get Chris on stuff, you know what I'm saying? Because he just a part of so much stuff, it's just hard to get the clearances. So he has a relationship with Chris, of course, because they came up together. So he hit Chris, and he called me like, Chris going to do it tonight. Meet us at Record Plant. So we go to Record Plant, and Chris like, ooh, this is hard. So Chris knock out his verse and shit. And then Taz is Omarion's manager. She manages Janae Aiko. Huh. So she's like, yo, D, I want to put Janae on this shit. I was like, bet. Like, that's cool. Let's do it. So then she sends me the verse, and she said, I'm going to eat the booty like groceries. I said, damn, Janae said that? So I'm sitting there with the damn, is that going to work? Like, eat the booty like groceries? Like,
And meanwhile.
Yeah.
Like, that's
that's like
the
biggest part of the song.
Biggest, totally. Yeah.
So I was on the fence to be like, yo, she might have to change that part because I don't know how people are going to receive Janae Aiko.
Yeah.
She's like not like what people see her now. Like she's a little more risky in terms of like you know, a personality. This is like early like good girl.
Yeah.
You wouldn't even think she talks like this, Janae. So she does that shit. We like, oh, man. So then it gets put together and we knew right then. It was like, oh, that's a hit. So then we brought it to Atlantic, and Omarion is like, you know, like, they got so many artists, it's like, he's kind of being overlooked a little bit.
Overlooked.
And, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Overlooked.
Overlooked. Yeah. So, I remember playing a record, and it was just like, okay, cool. Like, y'all could put that out. Like, it wasn't no, like, you're about to kill the game with this shit. And I remember,
why is every Chris Brown record you work, like, sort of just like, eh, whatever.
Exactly. Man. So, Juliet Jones calls one day. She's the head of promo. Shout out Juliet Jones.
Yeah.
One of the biggest, you know, part of my career, too. Outside of Sherry, she's, like, definitely been super important to my role here.
And their offices were next to each other.
Yep.
Yeah.
And she's like, yo, this song is, like, they're reacting. Like, PDs are calling me. It's like, because we're not working it like that. It's just kind of, like, out there. We serviced it, but it's not, like, it's not an impact date or nothing.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And I don't even think we have all the clearances yet. You know what I'm saying? Because, so then, they're like, yo, so we had to pay for the record. Mustard, you know, he wants his check.
Yeah, yeah.
He's, like, the hottest producer, like, this year, like,
it's
that year.
Check.
He's like, it's, like, a real check. So we pay Mustard, and that shit goes impacts, and that shit just went, like, fucking wildfire.
That's
man.
A big plaque right there.
Yeah, I love that plaque. That's three times platinum.
Yeah.
Where's the craziest place you've ever seen Omarion dance? Because he dances everywhere.
Yo, Omarion, the craziest place I've seen Omarion dance. Damn, where was we at? I feel like I have a good one. Because he dances everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you catch Omarion dancing anywhere. But, like, Omarion a cool dude, man. Like, people are like, he's like one of the coolest, smoothest dudes like ever, man. You know what I'm saying? But he just wanted on. He's a dance machine.
I feel like last night you mentioned something about Jhené Aiko.
The first time you met her.
Well, yeah. So when I was at Warner Brothers after we did the Maybach deal, it was still like it was before it took off. So, and it was a big deal, like in terms of like money spent and Warner Brothers, we still had to prove like that deal was worth it. So, but I had a relationship with 2 Chainz
mm-hmm.
at the time, and I really was trying to get
shout out to Tech, by the way.
I was trying to get 2 Chainz, man. And I remember I had a relationship with Shaka Zulu,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that their relationship was deteriorating. So I was like, yo, Shaka, like, can we figure out a way? And Shaka was like, yeah, we can work it out. Like, basically, so I was talking to 2 Chainz every day. Like, 2 Chainz was being real cool, man. He like really was down. He was coming around doing records with us and shit, because it was part of a lot of the earlier projects I was part of. 2 Chainz would come through, give us a verse, and it was somebody I was really trying to sign, man, and it just didn't happen, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And Jhené Aiko was one of the people that came to my office at Warner Brothers that it didn't work out, unfortunately. She brought her daughter because at the time she was being managed by the promoters that was doing all the hot parties, and I was at all the parties, so they're like, yo, we got this artist, her name's Jan, she's dope, you let me bring her through. I'm like, yo, so I'm trying to get it, but they're like, slow down, bro, you got like, you just did that, and like, do that first, then you can do that, then I want a Future, because Rocco, Shakir signed Rocco to Def Jam,
right?
And I was around Rocco every day when he was making an album,
right?
And Future was used to be in the studio every day. So when he first did the Tony Montana shit, I went to Atlanta. I'm like, yo, Rocco, let's do this deal, man. He like, I need X amount of dollars. Like, it was like a crazy number.
Yeah.
And I was like, bro, like, I don't know if I could get that, but like, let's try to figure it out. And he was like, well, just tell Joey to come down here, man. And Joey was like real busy that week, and he couldn't get down there. And then it just evaporated. But yeah. I was on it like every
those
day. Like
three artists.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like. And those are ones like I was really like, I like really went back and forth with them, like, yo, let me do this, let me do this. It wasn't a like passive, like, oh, like at that point I had confidence.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, I gotta do let me do this. And they're like, yo, slow down.
Where were you the night that Meek sent off all those tweets?
Oh yeah. That was a crazy night. So he was on tour, so I literally just left the tour. Because I was back in L.A. and stuff, and, like, I was like, man, we on so much fire. I'm about to take the rest of the year off. Be, like, number one 2 weeks in a row on the Billboard one.
Yeah.
And he's like, we got 3 more singles on here that's about to be. I don't have to work no more this year. I was about to just tell Julie, like,
you're
working from home for the rest of the year, man. And she like, I don't give a fuck. Just do it. Like, that was such a good grace at that time with that, because that album was, like, just performing crazy. But yeah, man, I got a call from one of my homies. Like, yo, you see what Meek talking about? I'm like, what you talking about? Like, go to Twitter right now. So I go there. I was like, oh man, this is gonna be a long summer.
Did you think? Because my first thought was like, there's no way that's him really tweeting. I was like, he got hacked. He definitely got hacked. And then like,
I thought he did too. What you said? I'm not hacked. I said no. Well, like, damn. Why can't this be a hack situation? I'm like, do we really need to go to war with Drake this summer?
The thing that really, really, really sucked about that is that Rico record was so good.
It still went platinum.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're right.
It's a great record. You didn't shoot a video for it. Like, didn't, like.
Man, we had that record. The Weeknd record was going to be the next record after that.
Oh, my God.
He had joints on there.
So
the Future record.
Yeah.
Jump Out the Face.
Yeah.
He was on fire.
That changed your whole summer up, huh?
Yeah, switched it up, to say the least. I mean, after that, with him, it was just like a lot of us understanding how powerful the internet was. Because, you know, at the time, like, you know, what you got to understand around this time, like, when Meek is in the streets going around, people ain't saying the stuff they say on the internet. So he's not even feeling, like, what the internet is, like, really talking about. Like, he's going around, he's still getting the same love. I mean, of course, we saw the sales slow up. But, I mean, it wasn't, like, a place where he was just, like, damn, like, nobody's talking to me no more. Like, he's still going around, people showing him love, whatever. But then he goes to jail.
Right.
So he's locked up.
Right.
So it's really like just a point where everything's just on hold now.
There was just a lot of stuff at the same time. The Drake thing, the jail thing. He was dating you know, the biggest female.
I mean, that happened when he was in jail. So when he was in jail, they like got closer.
Right.
And they start, I guess they started like, you know, just like communicating more. And when he got out of jail, I think that's when it got real.
Gotcha. Yeah. And but that's a lot. And that's a lot of change. Mm-hmm. And then does a label try to push music from him? Are you looking to create more?
Yeah, like how close are you in all of this? Because like, you know, there's a lot of things happening within like his world.
Man, I'm like, he's like kind of like one of the artists I'm closest to, like that I work with, because, you know, like his friends are like my friends now, you know what I'm saying? So it's like we're just always communicating. So it was just like a thing, like when he got out of jail, I just wanted to make sure like I was there to make music with him, or just like be part of help him like get back on his feet, you know what I'm saying? Because I know he wanted to record as soon as he got out.
Yeah,
because he was real focused in jail. You know, when I talked to him in jail, he'd be like, yeah, when I get out, I want to do stuff like this. And he was like really just focused on like just making hot music again.
That Meek and Nicki record went platinum, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's a big record too, and yes, still gets played.
Yeah.
Was there any, I mean, was that a natural thing that they did? Was that something that you were like, hey, you guys should record together?
Well, he got a batch of records from Khaled like way early in the process to record. I'm talking about like probably like 10 months before we finished the album, you know what I'm saying? And Nicki always liked that record. It was just like a Casey Kasem joint. It was like the hook was a little bit different. And Nicki was like always telling him, like, I like this record the best. So she was like, I'm going to jump on that joint. So he's like, all right. So she jumped on it. Then we had to get someone on the hook. Chris Brown. We got to get Chris Brown again. So Chris Brown kind of changed the hook because the hook wasn't as good as it is now. Like, yeah. So he made tweaks in the hook.
Oh, he Miguel'd it.
Yeah, he Miguel'd it. Is that in the right way?
Yeah.
And we knew like it was a hit, man. So after that, it was just like it was on to the races, and we had a dope, you know, plan for his release, and they got to premiere the song on the BET stage for the awards.
Yep.
First time seeing them, you know, perform together and like really, you know, show their relationship. So it was dope.
What don't people understand about what A&Rs do?
I think people just think it's like, oh, you just gotta find a beat, or it's like they don't understand like the relationships you gotta, the like all the politics that goes into like putting hit records together. They have to understand like how much time you have to spend in the studio and the office. Cause you know, like a lot of times in office, you know, I might be chilling all day working hard, and I might go studio and I'm drinking and smoking and like with the artist and doing playing beats, and if a girl or whoever comes to you and they like, oh, I can do that, he'd be like, yo, I just spent the whole day and all this, I'm unwinding like right now, but I'm still working, you know. Right. And they don't understand. It's just like they think like just by knowing a song is hot that they could be A&Rs, but they don't understand like you have to win the respect of producers and writers for them to give you music. They're not just like, oh, you're A&R, here goes my catalog of hot stuff and go shop it all over the industry. They know they have to like really fuck with you. You can't get people or beats or all that stuff unless the artists or the producers or the writers fuck with you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can't get people on the features unless they have a relationship with you. You got to know their managers and all that stuff, because even if you're tight with the artist and the manager don't like you, you're not gonna get the feature. They're gonna be like, you're not doing that for him, I'll fuck with him. You know what I'm saying? So you have to know so many people, be so cool and elusive with everybody, and on good terms, and do good business. As soon as you do some fuck shit, yeah, and it gets talked about, you're done. They're not gonna give you nothing.
How did it come to be that Wale was gonna executive produce, or still is gonna executive produce Self-Made 4?
Well, Wale is like really the most like him and Ross, as far as like putting records together. Like they have like a real like skill at like, you know, like putting the features and like where to put that artist, or like Wale, like he's really underrated as a writer and as a producer, because if people really let Wale like really like blueprint their shit, he could really kill some shit. Like, but I think people, you know, like Wale has a stigma of being an asshole a little bit, and I guess like it kind of rubs some people the wrong way. But he's so like, Wale's so passionate about it. He goes to studio every day of his life. Like, I'd be like, yo, go on a vacation. Like, he would literally, if he went on vacation, would find a studio.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be like, bro, how'd you find end up in the studio in motherfucking Turks and Caicos? You'd be like, nah, I had to work. I had an idea. He loves the music more than anybody I know.
When Jay-Z gave that quote, and he was like, what three rappers are going to be around in like 20 years? And it was Cole, I think it was Drake, and it was Wale. Mm-hmm. And people were surprised about him picking Wale.
Yeah.
But he said that he was the most passionate, the most driven, the most.
Yes.
Was that evident, like, from the get-go?
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, when I say I learned a lot of stuff about music through Wale, it's like, he taught me how to push myself to the highest level to get the you know what I'm saying, the most out of me. Because it's like, for you to be, like, rich, famous, and work as hard as he does, like, he literally lives, breathes, like, the music. Like, he, like... he's like a real genius to me, like, for real. And that's why he's crazy, because it's really a thin line for a show, because that nigga knows how to make some fucking music. And even with this album, even though the sales are low, he still made a great album.
Yeah.
And it's going to be records that end up popping and might take that shit to another level. The people are like, okay, it just might be a slow grind, but he made some incredible music. And for you to be on your fifth album, people don't understand, like, to go recreate yourself and do different music and different sounds, and it's hard. Like, you know what I'm saying? The first two albums, yeah, the 5, 6,
yeah,
and you're still recreating, like, you know, evolving as an artist. Like, that's hard, man. It's not a lot of artists that get this far.
Yeah.
So I don't be understand why he don't be getting the respect of somebody alone. Like, yo, you did 5 albums? That's crazy. Like, and you're still here standing, and you're still young.
Yeah. Can you just talk about how, you know, certain A&Rs will work with talent that they've been given, and other A&Rs are more like, you know, finding talent?
I mean, I feel like, you know, you got two different kinds of A&Rs. You got the A&Rs that really don't sign stuff, that know how to make dope albums. You got the A&Rs that sign shit that don't know how to make albums. You know what I'm saying? And you got some A&Rs that know how to do both. And I really feel like I showed I could do both. And it's not that many A&Rs I really know that could do both. And, you know, I feel like, you know, personally, I don't be getting the recognition I deserve. But that five put fires under me drives me. Because it's like, bro, I did a lot of stuff. People be acting like, oh, well, he had Ross wasn't in the studio with us. He's an artist, too. So he wasn't in the studio every day making records with us or doing all this stuff or putting these songs or building these relationships. Or even with, like, K. Michelle, nobody wanted to sign K. Michelle. Like, you know what I'm saying? And it's not like, they're like, well, what else? I'm not done. You know what I'm saying? I'm not exiting the game at 50. Like, I'm 32, and I'm about to...
You made it to our podcast, and that's it. Like, you know, what else is there to do? Really.
Talk about Ross's estate down in Georgia.
It's beautiful, man. It's incredible, man. It makes you really realize, if you stay focused, humble, and hungry, the rewards that you could receive from that. You know what I'm saying? Because that house is so fucking retarded. It's like the biggest pool, like, home pool in America, like, in the world or some shit. Like, that's just like Olympic size. Like, we had a pool party there. Like, you couldn't even talk to the person on the other side. You had to, like, you know, get on a cell. Like, yo.
Yeah, it really, like, you know, makes you feel small.
Yeah,
for sure. You've played basketball in the indoor court?
I might have shot a shot. I ain't have a full game. Like, it's so much shit. Bowling. It's like... Bowling alley. You got movie theater. Like, all kinds of stuff in there, man. You can't even find, like, your way around that house. Did you see in Meek's video? Like, he has, like, a stack of, like, newspapers from, like, the 1930s and 20s and stuff that cost, like, $10,000.
Like, he has, like, original Dickens novels. Yeah. Like, it's so amazing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Everything he has.
Well, Jeff's favorite thing for a while was watching Ross on Snapchat while he was on house arrest.
Yeah. Like, I'm sorry he was on house arrest, but, like, it was the best just watching him explore his yeah, that was his Miami house, but it was the best.
Yeah.
Like, I sort of wish that he just wouldn't leave his house.
Man. It's so... He got horses on there. He got...
Yeah. I mean, oh, well, yeah. Now he, like, loves horses.
This guy is crazy.
I don't know how he can ride
a horse.
So
much taste, man. Like, good taste, man. Like, it's like... He has great taste, man.
Shouts to Chef D, his personal chef.
Yeah. That's right. So...
Everybody.
We just got the Wale album.
Yes.
We got 3 new Meek songs from Meek's birthday weekend.
Yep.
Which, by the way, you flew down to attend, and...
I had to be there.
No, but your luggage should have been there, too.
Luggage got lost, and I still was happy, man. Shout out Meek Mill.
Who else do we have to look forward to from your roster?
Well, this year, of course, we're going to do a Meek album.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be this summer. And we're going to announce the signing of somebody really special from the West Coast.
We're not from the West Coast.
Yeah. Somebody special that his album's gonna drop this year. And
that's been a long time coming.
Yes. It's been a long, but I honestly feel like this dude made a classic album.
And by the way,
two of us.
By the way,
People who have been on this podcast have talked about this signing before. This is a long time coming. Yeah. This is really going to happen?
It's done. I can show you the text message right now.
This makes for good podcast material. Let me show you this text. It's getting mixed right now.
Look, this is the last text I got, and this was yesterday at 1:51 a.m. What did it say at the bottom?
Almost done.
Hey,
Almost done. The mixes. So is this going to be under...
Just Atlantic.
Atlantic.
Yeah.
Okay, it's official.
It's official.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm excited about this.
Great album.
It's like a classic for sure. I don't say stuff as a classic before it come out, but I got to live with the music for a while.
Wait, did you play it for that girl who was just like, sorry.
Yeah. Nah, she not even my friend
Is Chris Brown on this project?
No, he's not, unfortunately. Unfortunately, we love
so,
Chris
okay,
Brown.
We got that. Who else?
Just Meek and him, man, because Wale came out, then my new artist, L.A. from Atlanta, I dropped his project in March.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's
spelled
E-L-H-A-E.
Right.
Yep. And he's a dope R&B artist that I'm super excited about. He has a project called Aura 2 on Apple Music, Spotify. Check it out if you have time. It's really great. Some super cool R&B music. And he's on tour right now with Black Bear. Yeah, he's dope, man. I think this is going to be the year that he breaks for sure.
And now you're doing R&B just like you could have been doing at Warner.
That's right.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly.
Dallas, you're a guy who made it from very humble beginnings up in Flint, Michigan. You lost some people, whether in the physical or like, you know, to other jobs.
Yeah.
You have so many plaques up on the wall right now. You have a hella career and you're just getting started.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you're from Flint. You got a lot of drive for somebody from Motor City like that, right?
Man, definitely.
See that?
Yep.
Yeah. See that?
I like that. A lot of drive for the Motor City. Hey.
But congratulations on everything. We're really excited about everything that's coming out, and we'll be talking.
Yo, appreciate you guys. You guys are the shit. Definitely been studying you guys for a while, and I'm just excited about how much you guys have grown. And I'm glad I get to see you guys in the building every time I'm here.
Hey.
Yeah, every time.
Just get into actual Atlanta parties. Yo, thanks so much.
All right, for sure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's the Real Jeff. If people want to find out more about us, It's the Real, and more about our podcast, A Waste of Time with It's the Real, more about what we're up to on a daily basis, where can they go?
You can always go to soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. You can also go to soundcloud.com/itsthereal for all of our music. You can go to iTunes, search for A Waste of Time with It's the Real. We are also on there for our new album, Teddy Bear Fresh. You can search for It's the Real Teddy Bear Fresh. We are on Instagram at It's the Real, Facebook at It's the Real, Twitter at It's the Real, Snapchat at It's the Real, and It's the Real Eric because It's the Real was taken. We are also just around. Come find us.
Shout out to all the loyal listeners who have been listening since day one, since that Alchemist episode. We're 119 episodes in and still going strong. Thank you guys sincerely for listening. Please keep spreading the word. We like to spread the word about this podcast to all of our friends. Jeff, do you have a friend you would like to tell?
I want to tell my friend Sean Wynn, who just graduated from college.
Congratulations.
He just started will be starting a job at WME in LA.
Oh, shout out to all of our friends at William Morris, the finest agency in the land.
And also, he is best known to me for dressing up in a pink bunny suit, and searching for Easter eggs.
Is that something that his new bosses at WME know about?
Well, I sure hope so, and or I hope not.
Shout out to
Sean Wynn.
Sean Wynn.
All he do is win.
I would like to shout out Ayo Vante.
Yeah.
From Twitter, who has been regularly putting our lyrics up on Twitter and spreading the word about our new album, Teddy Bear Fresh, which drops May 26th.
I saw Ayo Vante in a Raven B. Verona Instagram Live.
Is that right?
Yeah, last night.
And he's really made it.
Yeah.
Shout out to Ayo.
He wasn't there. He was...
he was in the chat. Shout out to Ayo Vante. We appreciate the love. We appreciate everyone going to iTunes right now and hitting that pre-order because we're going to put up some numbers and we want to surprise everyone. Guys, the single is Waco. It's out there right now. YouTube.com/itsthereal. Press play. Leave a comment. Tell people about it. Go to SoundCloud and press play. Go to Spotify and sign up. Am I missing anything?
You are missing nothing.
I'm... Not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We will see you guys next week. Brat!
Metaphor Waste of Time comes from the new Spotify original podcast, Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty. Produced by Gimlet Media and the Loudspeakers Network, Mogul details the illustrious hip-hop career of Chris Lighty and his rise to success before an unfortunate and untimely end. This is a story that's bigger than music. It's the story of the American dream. Follow and listen to Mogul, The Life and Death of Chris Lighty every week on Spotify.